You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Treta Parsi, who is an award-winning author and the 2010 recipient of the Grawemeyer Award for Ideas Improving World Order. He is the founder and president of the National Iranian-American Council and an expert on U.S.-Iranian relations, Iranian foreign politics, and the geopolitics of the Middle East. His latest book, Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy, reveals the behind-the-scenes story to the historic nuclear deal with Iran. Treta Parsi, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Is this deal now under threat?
Oh, it certainly is under threat. We have an unfortunate situation with the Trump administration essentially indicating that the spectrum of the debate within the Trump administration is no more than between those who want to quit the deal right away and those who want to do it in a more sophisticated way so that they reduce the cost of quitting the deal, but not there's no voices inside that are really arguing that this deal is working and we are actually better off with it.
The stories I've seen about Trump wanting someone to find some way to claim that Iran was violating the deal, even if it wasn't, is that the sophisticated approach?
That is the sophisticated approach. The aim is to make sure that the United States essentially has the ability of getting out of this deal and shift the blame to the Iranians so that the Iranians will pay the cost of it. And that is called a sophisticated approach. And it's only sophisticated because the alternative that the Trump administration is looking at is so profoundly unsophisticated.
Which is to simply throw it out.
Throw it out. I mean, those voices who argued for that thought that if this ends up really upsetting the Europeans, that's just an added bonus.
Where's Iran? What do Iranians think, both the Iranian government and the Iranian public, of this deal?
So the public was tremendously supportive of the deal and remain supportive of the deal, but are very, very disappointed in feeling that the deal has not ended up working the way that they had anticipated, that the sanctions will be lifted in a much more efficient manner. And now seeing how Trump is working to undermine the deal and to make it even more difficult for businesses to go back to Iran, you clearly see that people are disappointed. It hasn't turned into a situation in which people think it's better to withdraw from the deal, but it has definitely hurt the view of the United States in Iran. And it has helped the hardliners in Iran who, throughout this process, made the argument, we can strike a deal with Iran, with the U.S., but rest assured, you cannot trust the U.S. The U.S. will not live up to its end of the bargain.
Did people originally support it so much primarily because the alternative was U.S. threats of war and so much worse? Because it doesn't seem like a great deal. It doesn't seem like the sort of deal that's imposed on any other countries on Earth. It seems rather unfair to Iran.
I actually think it was a good deal for Iran because at the end of the day, the key things the Iranians wanted was to get recognized that they're going to have an enrichment program. They're not going to give up what they believe is their sovereign right. And secondly, make sure that there would be sanctions relief. But the third unstated consequence of this is perhaps the most important one for the Iranians, which is that this deal ended Iran's isolation. Iran became an accepted party and recognized as a major power in the region. Those are the things that the Trump administration are most objecting to and they are walking back on. Those were not written into the deal, of course, but they were an unstated consequence of the deal. Those things were important for the Iranian public as a whole. And as a result, they did feel that this was a good deal for them. I mean, people were dancing in the streets in Iran when the deal was struck, but that was not the case in the U.S.
And is Iran complying with the deal? We certainly are seeing the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. and the White House saying otherwise.
So sorry, could you repeat the last part?
Is Iran, in fact, complying with the deal? We're hearing accusations.
Yes, certainly.
Of...
the Iranians, the IAEA inspects the deal and is responsible for making sure that every party is living up to the deal and reporting on that. And so far, they've issued 8 reports, all of them saying that the Iranians are living up to the end of the bargain.
And yet we're seeing new sanctions legislation, including sanctions against Russia and North Korea and Iran, all packaged together. What is the justification?
The justification from the congressional side, of course, is that they don't really need much of a justification to impose sanctions on Iran. They'll do that in their sleep. But the main official pretext that is provided is that Iran is still engaged in regional activities that the United States objects to. That is not to say that Iran is not doing that. The reason why I say that it's more of a pretext is because at the end of the day, Saudi Arabia is engaged in far, far more problematic behavior in the region. And the United States is continuing to not only deal with the Saudis, but Trump went to Saudi Arabia, said that there would be no criticism of Saudi Arabia, and then signed the deal to have $110 billion of weapons sold to Saudi Arabia. The most destabilizing event of the Middle East in the last 30 years was the invasion of Iraq. The Iranians have done a lot of bad things in the region, and they have done things that destabilized it. But there's nothing they've done that has been even close to as destabilizing as the invasion of Iraq was, which was conducted by the United States.
And when you say that they gained recognition as a leader in the region, what does that mean?
Not as a leader, but recognition as a major power in the region. Because up until that point, the United States pursued a policy of containing and excluding Iran from every political forum. When there were negotiations about Syria, the Iranians were not there, which is part of the reason why those negotiations didn't go anywhere. So the Iranians were essentially an unaccepted entity in the region. They were excluded from the regional decision-making table. And it was a critical thing for them to be able to regain a seat at that table. This is what they call decontainment. That's been an overwhelming objective of the Iranians for the last 20 or so years.
And what has been the economic impact in Iran of all the sanctions and on the flip side of the deal having been put through?
Well, the economic effects of the sanctions early on were quite devastating for the Iranians. The Iranian economy suffered tremendously under these sanctions. At one point, the Iranian currency dropped 30% in less than 3 days. As a result of the sanctions. The lifting of the sanctions has not had the anticipated effects on the economy. Oil sales have done quite well for the Iranians, but they have had a great difficulty attracting businesses back into Iran, particularly investments. And investments are needed in order to create jobs, not just make sure that there's more money pumped into the economy. And part of the reason why businesses have not come is because a lot of businesses are very worried that the United States is going to walk out of the deal and that sanctions will be reimposed. It would be very costly for them to go back into Iran and then end up getting kicked out again as a result of U.S. sanctions coming back into effect.
Yeah. We're speaking with Trita Parsi, whose latest book is Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy, and who is the president of the National Iranian American Council. Trita, who opposes the agreement with Iran, and what arguments can they possibly put forward?
So the first thing we have to keep in mind is that this deal was overwhelmingly supported by the entire international community. It got an unanimous vote in the Security Council. There were only 3 places where the opposition was strong. One was in the office of the Israeli Prime Minister. Second was in the palace of the House of Saud in Riyadh. And then thirdly, amongst Republicans in Congress. The reasons for their opposition varied. For the Republicans, it was as simple as this is a Obama deal, and as a result, they are going to be against it just as much as they have essentially been against everything else that President Obama did. For the Saudis and the Israelis, it was a bit more complex. I explained it in detail in the book, and I conducted interviews with essentially everyone who was involved in this, from the Iranian foreign minister to Secretary Kerry to Federica Mogherini, as well as Israelis and others. For the Israelis, it was very much about the fact that if the U.S. struck any type of a deal with the Iranians, it would lead to Iran's decontainment. It would lead to an end to Iran's isolation and exclusion in the region. And the Israeli fear was that, well, the U.S. will strike this deal. The Iranians will make up with the U.S. on a whole set of issues. They will no longer be fully contained. But it doesn't mean that Iran will change its position on Israel. It does not mean that Israel will not continue to face difficulties from Iran. So this became a key reason as to why the Israelis then did everything they could to undermine the deal, essentially saying, we're not going to allow the United States to come to terms with Iran if Iran does not also come to terms with Israel. And there has been a change in Iran's posture on Israel at a minimum. You don't see the Iranians behaving or speaking about Israel in the same manner today as they did during the Ahmadinejad years. But it's clearly not sufficient for the Israelis. At the same time, it has to be said, the Israeli security establishment, those who actually were very worried about the nuclear issue, are quite happy with this deal. It's the political establishment in Israel that has seen this as more than just a nuclear issue and also see a clear domestic political angle to this in Israel, in which opposing the United States doesn't make a lot of sense, but for Netanyahu to oppose Obama actually was good politics.
And is Iran actually harmful to Israel or threatening to Israel? What is the problem from Iran in Israel?
Well, Iran definitely poses a challenge to Israel, but the idea that Iran is an existential threat to Israel does not have a tremendous amount of support in the security establishment. It is definitely a line that Netanyahu uses extensively and frequently, but it is not something that many others within the security establishment agree with. Even people like Ehud Barak have been on record saying that it's laughable. Iran is a threat. It is not an existential threat, because to call them an existential threat is to really diminish Israel's own capabilities. And three heads of the Mossad in a row have said this. Iran is not an existential threat. Iran is a challenge. Iran is a threat, but not an existential threat.
But does the Iranian government actually threaten to attack Israel in the way that the U.S. White House threatens to attack Iran or North Korea?
No, you don't have those type of a threat. You have very vicious statements, of course, in which the Iranians question Israel's legitimacy, make the prediction that Israel would not exist, and there's a lot of counter threats or warnings in which the Iranians say that if the Israelis attack, Iran will do X, Y, and Z, and Iran will, at one point, the supreme leader in Iran even made a very specific threat, saying that if the Israelis attack, Iran will target Haifa. But then, of course, the Iranians are arming Hezbollah. Hezbollah is still at loggerheads with the Israelis. So it is a situation in which both sides are stuck in a security dilemma, and they are perceiving threats from the other side. The question is, once there was a deal and the nuclear issue was taken off the table, there was an opportunity for a more inclusive dialogue about security in the region. There was an opportunity for the Israelis to see how Iran's policies, et cetera, could be changed as it improved its relations with the United States. Instead, the Israelis chose to go in the opposite direction, as did the Saudis. Did everything they could to not only kill the deal, but to make sure that there would not be an all-inclusive security dialogue, that there would not be a dialogue that also included the Iranians. Instead, they preferred to go back to a scenario in which the U.S. and Iran were essentially lethal enemies. The Saudis in particular was quite clear. They preferred an Iran that actually had a nuclear weapon but was isolated in the region than one who didn't have nuclear weapons but had a more functioning relationship with the United States.
Trita Parsi, you say that the Republicans in Congress opposed and presumably still oppose the deal just because it was an Obama creation. Yet many of the arguments they made were that Iran was an immediate threat and needed to be attacked, that the U.S. needed to go to war. And they tended, as usual, to say such things roughly in proportion to their election funding from war profiteers. Was all of that sort of rhetoric, and the true motivation was just opposition to Obama, or is there a drive to war that infects the U.S. Congress?
Well, without a doubt, there are other aspects involved in this as well. And you mentioned that many of them saw a particular profit in war. That is the case. There's also another factor, which is by taking Netanyahu's side against the Democratic president of the United States and the Democratic Party, there was clearly a calculation among some of the Republicans that they would now out Israel, the Democrats, on this issue, be better on Israeli security, in their view, than what the Democrats were, in the hope of increasingly attracting major donors that otherwise were giving to the Democratic Party to have them shift over to the Republican Party. The Republicans have hardliners such as Sheldon Adelson, et cetera. Why not have five more of those? Why not do something that would clearly bring more of those people to the Republican side? This has been a long-term effort, and the Iran deal was one significant opportunity for them to do so.
You mentioned Hezbollah. What about all the U.S. accusations that Iran is the biggest war maker, the biggest terrorism backer? I mean, obviously, nothing Iran or anyone has done compares to the invasion of Iraq, or probably to the overthrow in Libya or the destruction of Yemen and so forth. But what substance is there to the charges in regards to Yemen and elsewhere around the region?
Well, when it comes to Iran's support for Hezbollah, there's no doubt about that. Iran is a major sponsor of Hezbollah, and Hezbollah and Iran's relations remain very, very close. Iran's role in Yemen is highly overstated, particularly in the beginning when statements were being made that the Iranians are behind the Houthis, etc. At that point, it was simply not true. Their role was very, very limited. But over time, it has actually grown. It's almost become a self-fulfilling prophecy. But when it comes to destabilizing the region or being the most dangerous element in the region, there is a tremendous amount of exaggeration and irony in many of these things. Just take a look at the State Department's own list of state sponsors of terror or terrorist organizations. The United States accuses Iran of being the main state sponsor of terror. Yet when you take a look at the State Department's list of terrorist organizations, more than 40 of them are Wahhabi organizations or Salafi organizations with connections to Saudi Arabia. Only two or three of them are organizations that are either Shia or otherwise connected to Iran. Yet Iran is accused of being the main state sponsor of terror. 15 Saudis were behind 9/11. Accusations exist that the Saudi government was not entirely innocent in all of this. Yet the United States is not calling out Saudi Arabia. On the contrary, Trump went to Saudi Arabia and in Riyadh he said, "We're not here to criticize." 3 days later, he's in Brussels, and he had nothing but criticism to America's European allies. So there is a tremendous amount of inconsistency and, frankly, double standards here. It's not to say that the Iranians are playing a wonderfully helpful role in the region, but the United States' targeting of Iran and turning a blind eye to what the Saudis are doing reveals that there's something much, much more important going on than just a fair calling out of parties engaging in terrorism.
There probably is a solution if you keep talking about that State Department list of terrorist organizations too much. They could stop publishing the list. That would solve the problem, right?
That would be one way.
What about in Syria? What about Iran's? I mean, this is all incredibly hypocritical in that the U.S. is not on its own lists of terrorists and war makers. but what about Iran's role in Syria?
The Iranians have been supporting of Assad and played a critical role in ensuring his survival, which then also means that they are complicit in some of the crimes that the Assad regime has committed. At the same time, other parties are in great support of some of the opposition figures, and many of the opposition figures have essentially been succumbed into ISIS or al-Nusra, and are also responsible for a tremendous amount of crimes in Syria. It's a tremendously complicated picture where there is truly no good guys, in my view. There's no one with any clean hands in that scenario. And the thing we have to focus on more than anything else is to try to see how the bloodshed there can be de-ended. Most civil wars rarely go beyond 1 year. Countries simply lack the capacity to be able to sustain a warfare against itself for more than that period of time. When they go above 1 year, it's almost exclusively because outside parties are pouring in arms, money, sometimes also soldiers. And that is certainly the case in Syria. That is an area in which both the United States, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Iran, Qatar, Saudi, Russia, all of them have unfortunately played a negative role in my assessment.
Yes, indeed. I'd add the United States as well. The thing is, every several years, or even faster, there seems to be a big push in Washington, D.C. for a war on Iran. I mean, it seems like around 2007, maybe 2015. But each time, shouldn't the case be weaker simply because the war was not engaged in last time, and the world did not fall apart, and all of the threats did not come true, and we managed okay without the war? I mean, doesn't that weaken the case each next time it's brought up?
It should be, but the issue, of course, also is that there isn't a strong case for war with Iran in the first place.
Well, of course not.
What you really have here, I think, and I write about it extensively in my book, that's part of the reason why the title is called Losing an Enemy, it's about the fact that there are plenty of people in Washington and also folks in Tehran who are more terrified of losing Iran as an enemy or losing the U.S. as an enemy than they are afraid of the actual threat the country could pose. So. Yeah. They do everything they can to prevent any solutions and everything they can to prevent anything that actually could cause the United States to lose an enemy. And for some of them, not all, the real issue is that they want strong American hegemony in the region. If you want strong American hegemony in the region with a very, very strong military presence there, whether Iran is under the current government, whether it's under the current government of the Shah or a future democratic government, you will most likely end up in a conflict with the Iranians because the Iranians don't want any foreign presence in the region as a whole. And they want this for a selfish reason, because as long as there's no major foreign powers in the region, Iran will be one of the biggest powers.
Yeah. And
if you want this, that will be your primary objective, which then supersedes all other factors. You will turn a blind eye, and you will ignore the fact that the U.S. and Iran have common interests against ISIS, for instance, because that is secondary to your primary objective of hegemony. It also means that you will turn a blind eye to all of the crimes the Saudis are committing, because at the end of the day, that also is secondary to your primary objective, which is hegemony, and the Saudis don't only want hegemony, they support it. They want American hegemony more than the United States wants American hegemony. That's part of the reason why you have this rather bizarre situation in which there's so much focus on Iran and so much negligence and so much turning a blind eye on what the Saudis are doing.
I think you're absolutely right. It also seems that in U.S. politics, there is, again, the desire for profits for funders and for political gain for heroic war leaders. And it seems like there is this possibility that after all the bluster directed at North Korea, there could be the substitution of Iran as a target. And I wonder what you think of that possibility and what you think of what that would do to nuclear proliferation, to once again...
Sorry, you broke up there for a moment. Can you repeat?
Do you think it's possible that the United States will turn towards Iran as a target for war instead of North Korea? And do you think that would be damaging to nuclear proliferation, to again refrain from attacking a nuclear country and attack one that's agreed and complied with a nuclear disarmament agreement?
So I think we're not at a point right now in which we can say that war is around the corner, but there's a couple of steps that the Trump administration is thinking about, and they may take them as early as next month. And that would definitely put us on the path towards war with Iran. Now, whether the United States goes to war with Iran or if it just walks out of this deal, it will significantly harm not just the U.S.'s ability to strike another non-proliferation deal with North Korea, but frankly, potentially any deal, because the United States will have then a track record within the last couple of months of having walked out of the Paris Agreement, having walked out of the Iran Agreement, having started questioning NATO, and as a result, the value of America's signature on the paper, on a paper, will significantly drop.
I agree, although I wish it were seriously questioning NATO and abolishing it. What about, we have just a couple minutes left, what about the latest news in the efforts to ban Muslims in terms of immigration policy? Does this come out of all of these wars? How does it interact with propaganda around foreign relations?
It certainly seems to have some connections there, because once again, if this truly was about security, then the United States would have done something to do a better job at screening people who have either visited Saudi Arabia or are Saudi nationals, mindful of the fact that 94.1% of all terrorist deaths on U.S. soil have been conducted by citizens of Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and UAE. Zero
foreign terrorism, excluding domestic terrorism.
Yeah, domestically. Zero terrorist deaths on U.S. soil have been conducted by the citizens of the six countries that are targeted by this Muslim ban. So the idea that security is behind this is really, really a stretch. Even the DHS itself came out with a report and saying that nationality is not a good predictor of terrorism, and as a result, measures of this kind cannot really be claimed to be helpful towards security. What can help explain what is done, to be frank with you, mindful of what we saw, the president's reaction to what happened in Charlottesville, in my view, is that there definitely seems to be a racist component to what is taking place here.
Very much so. Trita Parsi, to be continued at a future date. Trita Parsi's book is Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Trita, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it. Thank you.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, virtually every newscast will contain some item about the economy. It's always been a very inexact way to talk. The economy encompasses many factors and many actors. But as a new report underscores, even if we're just talking about people's economic well-being, speaking in broad terms doesn't just miss a lot, it's anti-explanatory. It obscures more than it reveals. The report is called The Road to Zero Wealth: How the Racial Wealth Divide is Hollowing Out America's Middle Class. It explores why that wealth gap exists and how we might intervene to turn it around. Because if we don't, we are driving the country toward what the authors describe in no uncertain terms as a racial and economic apartheid state. Diedrich Asante Muhammad is one of the report's authors. He's senior fellow, Racial Wealth Divide, at the group Prosperity Now. We'll be talking with him about that. But first, we'll take a quick look back at recent press. There were many lowlights of Donald Trump's September 19th speech at the UN, but for many, the nadir was his statement that, quote, "The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea." Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime. Close quote. But for corporate media, the announcement of the possibility of killing 25 million people was no big deal. For the New York Times, it was Trump showing his usual confrontational style of leadership. The Washington Post wondered about the idea that Trump's remarks about North Korea were a break from past U.S. policy. Wired magazine told readers that there are two very important things to understand about North Korea in this context, neither of which is that it contains millions of human beings. They were instead that no one has perfect insight into what Kim Jong-un thinks, and that North Korea is paranoid that the United States is going to eliminate them. Though the writer did add that, quote, "In fairness, Trump's remarks may have been precisely calculated, a four-dimensional chess move designed to bring about a political outcome rather than barreling toward a disastrous use of force," close quote. And in an article for which he was presumably paid in actual money, CNN's Chris Saliza declared Trump's UN speech, quote, "in a word, Trumpian," close quote. Recalling previous bellicose threats, Saliza notes, quote, "the promise to totally destroy an entire country seems to take things even a step further," close quote. Of zero interest to serious journalists was the fact that countries who signed the UN Charter in 1945, as The Intercept's John Schwartz reminded, are not supposed to wantonly threaten use of force against other states. And even including his phrase about the U.S. being forced to defend itself, the rules of preemptive war require proportionality and necessity that Trump's statement do not evince. Schwartz quotes the vice president of the European Society of International Law, who called Trump, quote, "morally repugnant for treating the 25 million people of North Korea as something to be extinguished at will," close quote. Corporate media's blasé attitude to genocide isn't confined to Trump. As Adam Johnson noted for FAIR, a week or so back, CNN's Jake Tapper conducted a chummy interview with John McCain, in which the Arizona senator casually declared, quote, "if Kim Jong-un acts in an aggressive fashion, the price will be extinction," close quote. Note that McCain didn't say if North Korea attacks the U.S., but simply if it acts in an aggressive fashion. But not only did Tapper not ask him to clarify that, he had no follow-up at all about the tossed-off threat to kill millions of people. He just moved along to a question about immigration. Nothing to see here. In related news, the September 18th New York Times reported on the Senate passage of a bill giving the Pentagon $700 billion, more money than Trump even asked for. As Ben Norton noted for FAIR, the story all but openly applauded the bill, calling it a rare act of bipartisanship that sets forth a muscular vision of America as a global power. The article quoted three people, only one of whom was not an elected official, none of whom opposed the budget expansion. That one non-official was Anthony Cordesman, who, though the paper didn't disclose it, was previously John McCain's national security assistant and a former employee of the Pentagon, the State Department, and NATO. Cordesman now is an analyst at the bellicose think tank, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, which, though the paper didn't disclose it, is funded by the governments of the U.S. and its military allies, along with leading corporations in the arms industry. Cordesman used his space as a putatively independent expert in the U.S. newspaper of record to make the absurd claim that the Senate's gigantic Pentagon bill was a response to years of underfunding of the U.S. military. That would be the same military funding that accounts for nearly half of U.S. discretionary spending, and at $611 billion in 2016, represents more military spending than the next eight largest countries combined, six of whom are U.S. allies. By way of reference, the UN and anti-poverty organizations have estimated that it would cost just $30 billion a year to end world hunger. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The lead of the Washington Post story reads, quote, "The incomes of middle-class Americans rose last year to the highest level ever recorded by the Census Bureau, as poverty declined and the scars of the past decade's Great Recession seemed to finally fade." Close quote. The piece ends with a source's comment that this is unambiguously good news. Somewhere in between, you might catch the notes that inequality remains high and yawning racial disparities remain, but the story's framing encourages you to see those as asterisks. Much media coverage presents the economic well-being of non-white Americans as an afterthought or a tangent from an overall picture. And if those groups' fortunes are out of step with those of white people, the implication is that they'll catch up with time. Whatever positive trends there are will naturally trickle down to them at some point. But this implication is wrong, and it would be important to understand why it's wrong, even if Black and Latinx people were not on course to be the country's majority. A new report helps us see what's happening. It's called The Road to Zero Wealth: How the Racial Wealth Divide is Hollowing Out America's Middle Class. It comes from the groups Prosperity Now and the Institute for Policy Studies, and we're joined now by one of its authors. Diedrich Asante Muhammad is Senior Fellow, Racial Wealth Divide, at Prosperity Now. He joins us now by phone from somewhere near Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Diedrich Asante Muhammad.
Thanks for having me.
The census report is about income, of course, money from wages or capital gains. And this new report looks at wealth, which is the amount of assets someone has after you subtract their debts. Can you tell us why you think it's important to focus on racial disparities in wealth and then give us a sense of what that gap looks like?
Yes, I think wealth as a foundational economic indicator is very important. Wealth tells a stronger story about where people are situated socioeconomically. Wealth is what allows people to ride out or deal with challenging economic times, which we all go through. Wealth is what allows you to take advantage of opportunities that might put you in a better socioeconomic position in the future, whether it's starting a business, money to buy a home, money to go to higher education with less debt. And so we see that wealth is a much stronger indicator of the socioeconomic status. And we think this is what needs to be looked at more often to help us understand how the economy is doing. And let me point out related to the article you had previously mentioned about, you know, middle income being at the highest it's been and that we've kind of recovered from the Great Recession. I think it's great. You know, we need strong incomes. We need strong employment figures. And racial minorities, Blacks and Latinos in particular, still have great divides in income and employment. But I also want to note that for the country as a whole, Black, white, or Latino, no one has recovered in terms of wealth from where they were before the Great Recession. And I think too often people get it wrong, that people just feel like the recovery hasn't touched them, but it deeply has. But when you look at wealth, no one has gotten near to the wealth they had before the Great Recession, regardless of race. So there is a strong reason for all Americans to feel more economically insecure than they did before the Great Recession.
So the numbers and the information in this report, there are a number of different ways that you come at it, you know, in terms of data. But what can you tell us about the size of this gap in wealth, according to race?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's also helpful to understand the difference in income and wealth. Like African-American Latinos make about 60 cents on every dollar, or about that, depending on how you measure it, that whites make. But in terms of wealth, the disparity is much greater. The median wealth for whites in 2013, where we have the most recent data, is about $117,000. That's the median wealth for whites. The median wealth for blacks is $1,700. The median wealth for Latinos is $2,000. So you see this huge gap of around $2,000 to $117,000 that shows a disparity that's even much greater than the strong disparity in income or in employment as well.
Well, before I ask what drives the wealth gap, what doesn't drive it that people might think does?
That's an interesting question. There's been some reports coming out recently from some Yale authors about how it's interesting that higher income whites are those who seem to be most off in understanding the economic difference between blacks and whites historically. And the Yale authors point to this idea that when people are economically successful, they like to believe that a system is working. And so then they must assume that when people aren't doing well, there's something that they aren't doing right. And they will underestimate inequality. And I think in general, in terms of economic differences and with wealth differences, there's some belief that, well, if African-Americans or Latinos, whatever group you want to focus on, would just use their money better, that they would be in a much better economic situation, versus that maybe something structurally has been driving the inequality that existed throughout the history of the United States. And I think we can point to what has structurally helped create the wealth divide and what is a challenge to the American middle class as a whole.
Yeah, you often hear about, well, if communities would value education, you know, that educational attainment is really the difference between lacking wealth and having wealth.
And that's one thing we highlight in the report as well, as we highlight that even if you look at educational attainment, you see there's massive wealth disparities. We see that whites with a high school diploma have more wealth, almost twice the wealth, of blacks and Latinos with a college degree. So education in itself does not at all bridge the racial wealth divide. And two, if you look back, again, median wealth for blacks is $1,700, median wealth for Latinos is $2,000. That's a very small amount. A minor car accident will wipe that away. That might cover your salary for a week or two, depending on what you're paid. So there's not much room for any type of error or crisis or setback, and not much money to take advantage of opportunity. That won't pay for a semester of college almost anywhere. So we see when you have that little, there's very little you can do to actually advance your economic fortunes when you're stuck at a 1,700, 2,000 median wealth that seems to be on the decline.
Well, you sort of hinted toward it, but here's where we do need to know some history, because when you hear about the creation of the middle class in this country, you know, it wasn't just history's inevitable march. You know, when we're talking about structural drivers, you know, there was policy behind that, right?
No, absolutely. The middle class wasn't something, one, many people might assume that the country has always historically been a, you know, large middle class economy, and that's not true. And it wasn't just market forces that created a strong middle class, and it wasn't just market forces that created, in particular, a strong white middle class. the majority of whites did not become homeowners until the 40s and 50s, you know, after the New Deal following the Great Depression helped create a strong social safety net to help all Americans and white Americans in particular to get back on their feet after the Great Depression and provided things like Social Security and other things to help people, and actually even like work opportunities to help people stabilize themselves economically. And then this was followed up with a very strong economy post-World War II with a lot of the benefits of becoming a victor in a global war and with this policy like the GI Bill that did massive investments in social infrastructure and massive subsidies to higher education, home ownership, that, as we know, in the 40s or 50s, we had outright legal segregation, outright legal discrimination that prohibited African Americans and other people of color to benefit from this mass investment that helped create the middle class, that made whites the majority homeowners for the first time, that made the American economy a strong middle class economy for the first time. Blacks, Latinos, Native Americans were not able to get that type of investment. And my analysis is, without that investment, Blacks, Latinos, and Native Americans and other people of color never will be able to catch up to the historic strong white middle class that we like to think back upon.
Well, home ownership, I know, is one of the things cited as continuing to drive the wealth gap that we see today. And there are some other things, though, as well. When you think about main drivers of this wealth divide, what are some of them?
Yeah, and home ownership, it's not just being a homeowner. And there is a massive divide in home ownership. White Americans have a home ownership rate a little over 70%. Blacks and Latinos are not quite 45% homeowners. And so that's a huge divide. But also, as Thomas Shapiro has shown, it's also the delay in home ownership is that African Americans in particular, if they do become homeowners 8 years later than whites. And that means getting 8 years less of a return on that home. We also have the fact that there still is discrimination in the marketplace and that a home in a predominantly black neighborhood is going to be valued less than a home in a predominantly white neighborhood, which oftentimes means less appreciation. So even though home ownership is an important tool in wealth building, it is still a tool that African Americans and Latinos are going to get less of a return on than white Americans. And the same can be said about higher education. Higher education is very important, but you see that median wealth return is much less for blacks and Latinos with higher education than it is for white Americans. So even when people are doing things right, when we look at the highest income levels or highest educational levels, we still see this massive wealth disparity. And actually, I shouldn't even say when they're doing things right. I should say when they're able to attain those things that people say what you should be doing, becoming a homeowner, having high income, having high education, there's still this massive racial wealth divide.
Well, media talk incessantly about the middle class. You know, that's who we're told politicians need to appeal to, not the wealthy and certainly not the poor, but this sort of prototypical family who need and deserve the basics of a good life. You know, the Washington Post said they focused on the census report because it's one of the most closely watched indicators of how the middle class is faring financially. It seems like it's a murkily understood term anyway, but when you factor in race, the definition of middle class, the meaning of middle class changes.
Absolutely. And that's why we attempted in this paper to help lay out a definition of middle class by wealth, having middle class wealth, because oftentimes middle class is associated with a certain type of income earning. But if you look at middle class wealth, which we have put at being between $68,000 to $200,000, we then start seeing that the estimates of how many blacks and Latinos are quote unquote in the middle class are greatly decreased. We see that only about 30% of African Americans and Latinos have enough wealth to break into that $68,000 to $200,000 level of middle class wealth or higher. So really $68,000 or higher. While we see that over 70% of white Americans have this wealth of $68,000 or higher. Again, the median wealth for whites right now is about $117,000. So when we're doing an analysis of the middle class, we need to look much more at wealth indicators. And I think with that, we also know that the median wealth for the country as a whole since 1983 has been declining. It was a little over 70,000 in 1983. It was like 78,000, I think, in 1983, and it's gone down to 64,000 in 2013. And so what we're showing actually is already that a slim majority of Americans don't have enough wealth to have middle class wealth, to be what we would consider in the middle class.
Well, the big datum that's been emphasized in media coverage of this report is the fact that the median wealth of Black Americans will fall to zero by 2053, and Latinos sometime after that. And of course, we have to remember that median means half are below that. But that's if things are not made worse, if they just continue as they are. But it seems like things are being made worse, or the problem is being exacerbated.
Yeah, we've been using wealth data, strong wealth data. We found that you can start getting it, particularly by race, starting in 1983. So we looked at between 1983 and 2013 and looked at those 30 years to see if things keep going in that way, you know, what will happen with Black wealth and Latino wealth and white wealth. And we're seeing that white wealth, even with the Great Recession that did take wealth away from all Americans, white Americans never got below the median wealth of what they had in 1983. But we see that African Americans had $6,800 of wealth in 1983. Latinos had $4,000 of wealth in 1983. And in 2013, Black wealth had gone all the way down to $1,700 for African Americans, $2,000 for Latinos. And if we keep going with this 30-year trend, we are on a path where African Americans and Latinos are on a path to zero wealth. White wealth will continue to increase, though at a small rate. And one of our great concerns, though, is that, you know, we believe that the declining wealth of Blacks and Latinos, two of the largest minority groups in a country that's becoming majority minority, is helping to lead the bringing down of the national median wealth, and is really a big sign of a collapse of America as a middle class economy. So, you know, we think these are issues that should be looked at. You know, we look at racial wealth divide as one of the most fundamental challenges to the American economy in the 21st century, not just the challenge of particular communities in our country.
Well, yes, that's important to emphasize. It's not about, oh, those poor Black and brown people. And I will note here that the report does also address declining wealth in Asian American communities and in Native American communities. That's in there as well. And it's really a question about what kind of country we want to live in. This information indicates that we're headed towards, well, it says, a racial and economic apartheid state, which I think people should just let sink in for a minute. But it is on that scale.
And to add on that, a worsening one. I mean, I think important in looking at racial wealth inequality is that the basic narrative for racial inequality is we might not be where we want to be, but we're headed in the right direction. This report and other reports we've done is showing that the country is not even headed in the right direction. We're headed in the wrong direction, where racial inequality is getting worse. And I do believe that racial economic inequality is the foundation of racial inequality. And, you know, and that's not good for the country and for the individuals who live here.
Well, let me ask you, what interventions, clearly intervention is necessary, what interventions do you think are appropriate?
Yeah, well, Prosperity Now and Institute for Policy Studies have been doing work for years now looking at the tax code. You know, many people will say, oh, well, there's not enough money for, you know, big government programs, even though it was big government programs that created the American middle class to begin with. And I would say in some ways we can't not afford to continue investing in the American middle class. But even if we weren't to spend any extra money, the country already spends over $650 billion a year in wealth development. The great challenge is that this money disproportionately goes to the already wealthy. So we're spending $650 billion in a manner that is allowing millionaires to get over $100,000 of benefit from our tax policies, while working class families are getting maybe $200 from the wealth development of policies and programs we have in our tax code. So we argue that we should turn right side up this upside down tax code so that asset development and wealth development is actually going to low-wealth households. I mean, that's one, I think, big, easy fix. And it's not easy in that it's not easily passed politically, but I think it makes a lot of sense to most people that we should be investing that type of money into low-wealth people, not so much into high-wealth people.
Well, finally, one of the things that takes things that we think of as straightforward and makes them difficult, as you say, is the political process. And for me, media have a role there in saying This is something we can achieve. This is something that's too hard. And in taking political resistance as being the same thing as popular resistance to an idea, I really fault corporate media with that. I just wonder, finally, if there's anything on this set of issues that you would like to see more of or less of from reporting that might shape how things go.
Well, I mean, I do think a stronger analysis of wealth and understanding economic well-being is very important. You know, so we don't just say, "Oh, well, income has gone up for the median, so everyone must be doing well." When we see that, you know, wealth has been going down for all Americans, I think it's really important to also note, you know, who isn't doing well. When you say that we already, or when the press says that we already have almost full employment. Well, African Americans have twice the unemployment of white Americans and have an unemployment rate that whites had during the height of the Great Recession. So, you know, we need to look, and, you know, and Latinos have a unemployment rate at about 6%, which is much higher than anyone would think for full employment. So we have to have a better lens at looking at racially how things are affecting people and wealth to get a better understanding of how the economy is going. And, you know, when the economy is doing well, who's it going well for? And is it going well mostly for people? Is it going well mostly for corporations, stock markets? We have to have a much stronger analysis in all of this and be more diligent in our reporting.
We've been speaking with Diedrich Asante-Mohammed, Senior Fellow Racial Wealth Divide at Prosperity Now. You can find their work, including this new report, online at prosperitynow.org. Diedrich Asante-Mohammed, thank you very, very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks again.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows as well as transcripts on our website, FAIR.org. The website's also the place to sign up to subscribe to FAIR's newsletter, Extra, or to our email network. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio Eco Shock. In our second half hour, I'll be talking with author, blogger, John Michael Greer. He thinks we can walk back technology to safer options that can live past the crash. But first, we explore the wonders of how the climate really works, why the ozone hole and climate change work at cross purposes, Antarctica and fires in the Southern Hemisphere. It's science, the way I like it, with Dr. Andres Holtz.
Radio EcoShock.
Wildfires are big news in North America, Europe, and Siberia. But what about in the Southern Hemisphere? In January 2017, during the Southern summer, Chile experienced the largest wildfire in its history. A new study recently published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences says wildfires in Southern South America have increased, and they will become more prevalent as global warming advances. But it's a complicated picture influenced by human behavior, the ozone hole, changing winds from Antarctica, and something called teleconnection. To sort it out, we've reached the lead author, Andres Holtz, from Portland State University. Holtz has a PhD in geography from the University of Colorado, but also a degree in forestry engineering from the Universidad de Chile in Santiago. His specialties include wildfires in southern South America as well as in Tasmania and New Zealand. Andres, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You study wildfires, and as we speak, you are in a heavy smoke event in Portland, and it's pretty bad around here too. What is happening in the Portland area?
Oh, we have basically a bit of the perfect storm combinations of factors between a very dry and warm summer that has dried all the fuels, and then apparently accident ignition, still to figure out exactly the details, but an ignition in a forest that is ready to burn, and here we go. I can barely see the silhouette of the mountains as we speak.
You know, as I look at the world fire scene, my question sounds simple. Have there been more forest fires in southern South America, and is it due to climate change? But reading your paper, it's a very complex mix of factors. First of all, how did you define southern South America?
That's a great question for a geographer. That's a constructed concept, much like Patagonia or the Pacific Northwest. If you ask 20 people in a room, everybody with a pen and a map, they're going to draw a slightly different region. And so it's a mentally constructed place. We generally speak about the Southern Cone or Southern South America, which includes Argentina, perhaps even bits of Uruguay and Southern Brazil and Chile.
To understand your work, we need to grasp a climate pattern called the Southern Annular Mode, or SAM. It's also known as the Antarctic Oscillation. Please describe that for us.
Sure thing. As you well pointed out, SAM, or the Antarctic Oscillation, it's basically much like a ring of various pressures, of usually high or low pressures, and this ring expands and contracts around Antarctica. There's also a northern annular mode, or the Arctic Oscillation, that is less known and less famous in the northern hemisphere because it's not as prevalent, because it's not as strong, and that's due to basically the fact that the northern hemisphere is a landmass continent, whereas the southern hemisphere is an ocean-dominated continent. And at the southern pole, you have this massive Antarctic continent surrounded by water. And so the actual ring is almost perfect, that when it expands, creates some or drives some particular weather pattern in the mid to high latitude in the southern hemisphere, and similarly in the Antarctic continent as well. And so listeners might be familiar with El Niño or La Niña, which is basically a combination of temperatures in the ocean that drives pressures in the atmosphere that then in turn drives weather patterns. This is more or less the same, with the difference, and the big difference, that it has, it's mostly and primarily an atmospheric pressure-driven oscillation. It has no ocean temperature component.
So what do pressure systems of Antarctica have to do with forest fires in South Chile and Argentina?
That's a great question. Basically, when this ring expands, and imagine that the boundary of the ring has high pressure centers, what it basically does, much like in the Pacific Northwest, where the westerlies are the one coming from the ocean that bring all the precipitation to these coastal areas, this ring, when actually expands with high pressure, blocks these westerlies. And so the westerlies that are carrying the precipitation go towards the poles, in this case, towards the south. And so we have extended and unusually long fire seasons or drought seasons because of that effect of the ring. Then in combination with more ignitions, primarily due to people, humans, living in the area, colonizing the area, traveling in the area, and also an increase in lightning that has been clearly driven by warmer waters, we have, again, this perfect storm of perfect combinations where we see more and more fires.
Now, I have heard of this described to me as a tightening of the winds around Antarctica by another scientist, and he said that affected the rainfall and fires in Australia's Tasmania and in New Zealand. Are we talking about the same thing?
We're talking about the same thing. So my work in Tasmania and New Zealand, it's trying to also understand the relative importance of SAM with ENSO, and also with the Indian Ocean Dipole, which is another oscillation that different parts of the Southern Hemisphere are exposed to or basically are influenced by. There's still work to do to understand how these actually interact and feed each other or even buff each other. But yes, it definitely affects very similarly precipitation patterns, temperature patterns, and fire patterns in both New Zealand and southeastern Australia, including Tasmania.
Now, I was surprised to learn from your paper that a major cause of this tightening around Antarctica was not global warming, but the ozone hole. How did that work?
Yeah, the ozone hole, it's an interesting one. And initially, this southern annular mode pattern deviation, if I can call it that way, meaning that instead of going positive, which is the expansion and created this sort of ridge that blocks the westerlies and creates drought and fire, then switches into negative, which creates actually high rainfall in southern South America and then so on and so forth. It turns out initially that the ozone hole was the first driver identified to influence SAM. A couple of years later, it turns out that also global warming affects the SAM. And it turns out actually that each of them affect them in opposite directions. The ozone hole pushes the ring towards the equator, and the global warming pushes the boundary of the ring towards the pole. And in short, the ozone hole way of impacting the SAM is, if we think about what the ozone does, it's basically, it's a layer that is in the stratosphere that basically converts the quality of the insulation into a quality that is less harmful for life on Earth. When it does so, actually, the stratospheres in above warms up. And so if you reduce the amount of ozone, the amount of conversion of this energy is less, and hence the stratosphere, particularly in Antarctica, has been cooling. And this cooling has been the one affecting now the troposphere underneath. And so the ozone hole is, through a vertical dynamics, is affecting the actual temperature conditions in Antarctica in the troposphere. That in turn now actually enhances the way that the vortex works out. And if you think of Antarctica being this massive continent, the center of Antarctica, or the largest half, which is called East Antarctica, has been cooling and cooling. And it's one of the regions around the globe, actually, that's been cooling, which in turn now West Antarctica, which is smaller, has been warming very rapidly. And so this cooling now, it's basically almost like a hole that has very high pressure, very cold. And so it it pulls the vortex towards it and makes it more and more faster with wetter and wetter conditions in actually mid and high latitudes in South and South America.
And one of the strange aspects, though, is that these changes, Antarctica is still quite far away from most of South America across an ocean. So please tell us about teleconnection. What is that and how does that affect what we're talking about, the wildfires?
Teleconnection is the idea there is a connection between two phenomena, in this case, meteorological or synoptic scale climate phenomena that are geographically remotely. And so we can run, for instance, correlations between one phenomena and another and have no clue how they're connected, but they seem to be correlated. It took for us ecologists to wait that the climatologists and atmospheric scientists could figure out what the mechanisms were, if there were any, of course, so that we can actually understand and then use it or apply to try to understand what those impacts were. And in short, it's basically propagations of heat waves between tropical latitudes in the case of warming that go polarward, or the opposite, basically high polar latitudes pulling these high or low ridges or rings of this boundary of the SAM that then in turn affects remotely precipitations all the way up to even northern Chile. There have been studies that have linked and this sort of cascade effect of chain effect all the way to the highlands and the mass of glaciers in the Altiplano at 17 or 20 degrees latitudes, how quick the actual glaciers are melting.
I find that amazing. I mean, we're talking about almost swirls of air, if you will, another kind of ocean that we humans are not really equipped to understand. You know, we don't run into this every day. So we're just finding out about teleconnection. I mean, one of the early scientific theories about how it worked turned out to be false. That's my understanding of it.
Yeah, well, my understanding of it, and I'm not a climate scientist, is that climate teleconnections really became popular when we understood better the 1982-83 El Niño event. It was the first time that we had satellite data that tracked not only the changes in the geography of the warm and cold waters in the Pacific Basin, but also the effects of those and the effects of those at tropical latitudes, but then also how those were pushing low and high pressure centers to different latitudes, to different longitudes, and how that in turn were actually affecting areas that were quite remote from the actual tropical latitudes. For instance, South Africa is affected by El Niño. It's far away. Same with India and things that are quite remote. But if you follow, much like a train, they are connected one wagon to the next one into this sort of chain of events or phenomena.
Now, humans have restricted the use of ozone-damaging chemicals. If the ozone hole begins to shrink, as we hope, does that mean that wildfires in the southern part of South America could begin to decline?
That's a great question. We were very hopeful of that. First, quick caveat is the ozone hole is recovering in a more erratic pattern that we or most scientists expected. And so we see that it's recovering, but then has something like hiccups and then expands again. And so most projections from a decade ago or so would have put a current ozone hole much smaller than we see today. That's one. And then the second is that now we have global warming affected the SAM as well. And so the SAM, it's, as I pointed out before, so global warming is pushing the SAM in the opposite direction. And so even though the ozone hole fully recovers, the SAM is going to remain in its positive fire-prone state. And so unfortunately, I don't think that's going to be the case, that fires are going to be are going to start declining in the future because of SAM, and let alone because of things like El Niño and even secular trends of warming that are more like steady warming up and up.
Well, let's get to your specialty in the forests themselves. What kind of forests are considered in your study?
This was a meta-analysis. It's a large synthesis of 17 plus 100 fire-scarred trees across from subantarctic latitudes at 54 degrees or so all the way to 22 in subtropical latitudes in northern Argentina, right at the boundary with Bolivia. And so it encompasses from tiny trees and what it would be almost boreal forest in the northern hemisphere, what we call subantarctic forest, which is a tiny, tiny biome or even ecosystem. Then moving farther north with more taller rainforests, cool first, then warm rainforests, then an overlap or a transition zone between temperate and Mediterranean type of forest, which would be basically like Western Oregon right here in terms of the analogy for the northern hemisphere. And then moving into more savanna-like type of forest in central Chile and also in northwestern Argentina.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with Dr. Andres Holtz about new science on why wildfires are increasing in the southern part of South America. So you study trees that were damaged by fires. How far back does that record take you, and what was the general period used for your paper?
The oldest fire scar that we found was in 990 AD, so basically 1,100 years old fire scar. And this was from a Fitzroya cupressoides, also termed the redwood of the southern hemisphere. So very wet rainforest that burned very infrequently and that had fire scars.
But you used from the 1600 ons for most of the basis of your paper, is that right?
That's right. Mostly because we wanted to see what most of the trees were telling us, we started the analysis during a period where our sample size was high, was strong enough.
All right. Now, you say the activities of humans are a further complication. We have colonists burning away forests for agriculture, later the whole technology of fighting forest fires. How did you account for that in your study?
Fortunately for this type of analysis, and unfortunately for the forests themselves, fire suppression in general, it's been a very incipient technological advance in southern South America. And so perhaps only in central Chile, starting in the 50s or so, and then also in some of the Araucaria monkey puzzle tree forest in the 40s in northwestern Patagonia, it's really the first time where we see a very small effort to stop fires. And because of that, that's exactly the time where we actually truncated the analysis.
And we know that wildfire activity is harmful to human health. In fact, I haven't been able to go outside as much as usual this summer due to multiple large fires in British Columbia and in Washington State. But you also suggest the release of carbon from increasing fires could become, quote, a strong feedback to the climate system. Please talk to us about that.
So carbon coming from fires in some particular years can be a significant contribution for the global carbon emission of a given year. And if this becomes more and more recurrent and becomes a norm, we know that higher concentrations of carbon in the atmosphere, like any other greenhouse gas, both delays the amount of heat that actually, or traps more heat, so increases the amount of heat that gets trapped in the atmosphere, and at the same time delays furthermore the release of heat into the outer space. So our greenhouse, we call it greenhouse because it's not a perfect greenhouse that fully keeps the heat, but definitely delays the actual rate of heat dissipation into outer space. And so it makes sense to think that if we have more CO2 coming out of fires, we're going to see more warming. And then in turn, those forests whose fires depend on higher temperatures are expected to see more and more fires along with longer fire seasons.
I talked to a Canadian fire expert who said that, sure, we expect some of that carbon to be recaptured as forests regrow, but if they get extreme fires in a short period of time, then the forests don't regrow and it converts into grasslands or some other type of vegetation. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. Some of the ongoing projects and also pending proposals, we hope they turn into projects in the future, are exactly trying to look at that. Are trying to understand what the short and mid-term impacts of particularly fires that burn on previous burns, what we call reburns, and what the ecological effect of that is. And our hunch is that to some extent, this might be a little lens into the future, maybe 50, 100 years from now, where vegetation dry out naturally, or not naturally, but directly from climate, not through burning, and that actually basically favors plants and taxa in general that is more drought adapted, whereas when fires burn and a wet forest or a mesic forest and then burns it again and becomes a shrubland or even a grassland, well, this might be actually a sort of a travel or a journey to the future to see how this forest might be in 100 years from now. And so understanding what are the main players of those novel ecosystems today can help us to perhaps develop policy around that or even agree on what we would like to see in the landscapes.
Once you assembled your record, Andres, of fires over several centuries, can we say for certain that wildfire activity has increased since the 1900s, say, in southern South America?
We definitely see, I think, both. We see variability in general, up and down, and in some areas we can say yes, we see an increase in fire activity. It's hard to see or to say that these increases are only due to global warming, because as I pointed out before, we need ignitions. And as most coastal rainforests on western sides of continents around the globe, ignitions are rare. And so we have yet to see a pervasive increase of lightning strikes everywhere in the southern, in the wet forests in South America. That said, we definitely see an increase in lightning activity, statistically significant, particularly steadily in the mid-1970s when ENSO and the Pacific Decadal Oscillation both flipped at their sign in 1976-1977, and that created massive changes in the temperatures of the water, the amount of pressure cells, the convectivity, which in turn drives ignition patterns and so on and so forth, in terms of lightning. And so I guess the answer, it depends, and in some places, yes, in some places, no. And to wrap up, then we also analyze the synchrony of fire activity, and that tends to be increasing in its amplitude, both in higher synchrony and in lower synchrony in very recent times. So it seems that in the past, it was less synchrony and less asynchronous, whereas more recently, we see a much more, I don't know, extreme pattern of very synchronous and very asynchronous.
What do you mean by synchrony in fires?
It's basically a simple idea that sites that are remotely locating are experiencing fires at the same time during the same fire season.
Now, who is watching and measuring these wildfires? Is it governments? Are there other institutions? Who's doing it?
Nowadays, fires are definitely being more and more considered, and I'm speaking now from a Chilean's perspective, into the national policy, into the national agenda. When I started working for my PhD, for instance, which was the first work I led in fire ecology and fire climate dynamics, I was told that fires were rare. Fires were only caused by the settlers that moved to Patagonia 60, 80 years ago, and the indigenous didn't burn, and so on and so forth. We had no linings, and it turns out that I found lots of fire scars that were pre-settlers, so the indigenous had to be lining, had to be igniting. I also found fire scars that I could tell were from lining, so there were also those. And so I feel that, and then as you well pointed out, last year or this past summer season, there were massive fires in central Chile. There were in 2015, there were big fires in these 1,000-year-old forests, Araucaria Forest, and even some bits of Fitzroya, both the monkey puzzle tree and the redwood in southern Chile and northwestern Patagonia in Argentina, that were burned. And people were very pissed off and very angry and very sad about this. And the government definitely struggled in terms of how to deal with this. They did the best that they could. But at the same time, now it's the idea to gather and think about policies for restoration, what restoration should look like, and so on and so forth.
What can our listeners in Australia and New Zealand learn from your newly published paper?
Well, New Zealand, it's a fascinating place to study fires, and collaborators there have been doing this for several decades. New Zealand is an area that is uber maritime, and so it's very hard for New Zealand to get any lightning whatsoever because it's so thin, and it's obviously extremely wet on the west side and less so in the east side. And New Zealand also, it's a natural, beautiful experiment because a laboratory, because it had no humans until 800 years ago. And so we can look at the non-human fire dynamics, fire climate dynamics, which, again, being so maritime driven, it was very, very slim and very, very few fires. And how then Maori people, Polynesians, change the vegetation through fire in just a few decades, even maybe a century or so. And even though it's been estimated that there were very few people. And so New Zealanders, I would say that they generally perceive fires as something totally foreign, totally alien. And in the last 10 years, I feel that that is also starting to change. And I think it was this past summer that New Zealand also saw some major fires outside of, I don't remember the city that it was, but it was, people were definitely concerned. In fact, I was at a meeting in May, I believe. Yeah, it was in May, where I sat down with a couple of New Zealand ecologists, and they were like, yeah, we were concerned. And so it's definitely something that's going to change. And one of the best papers and analysis on the impact points of going back to the SAM on drought and fire risk has been shown for New Zealand. And so even though it's so maritime, the only thing that it needs is an ignition at the end of the summer, and that forest or many of those forests can burn again.
I know. I talked to a fire expert in Tasmania, and they had a shocking fire season. As we all know, it was well reported in the world news. But even a forest in the northern part of Tasmania that hadn't burned for many, many centuries caught fire. It was a national park, I believe it was. It was very frightening for the people there.
Yeah, I have a hunch who you talk to, who is probably my collaborator in Tasmania, that I worked there as a postdoc fellow. And we were exactly working there in the central northern area where this 1,000-year-old forest, or I don't know, many hundreds of year-old trees, in this subalpine, almost tree-lined plateau, central plateau, it's called. It was very, very severely burned 3 years ago or so.
Yes.
2 years ago. And it was very scary. We are actually currently working on a landscape scale analysis of the fire refuges in Tasmania to try to see whether some of these very millennial scale longleaf conifers, very iconic species, have any chance, or what their potential conditions will be in the future when we unfortunately think that they're going to see more and more fires.
Well, as we wrap up here, Andres, what further research needs to be done now when it comes to Southern South America?
At this point, I feel that we have understand, or we have understood fairly well how climatic conditions are driving fires. But we have a lot to learn about how now ecosystems are responding to this apparent surge of wildfire. And so understanding how, for instance, invasive species affect the recovery of native forests, how native but also exotic mammals, for instance, are affecting the density of seeds that could potentially be coming to a forest, or if they are being browsed or predated, maybe they're going to be coming to that shrubland, grassland that we discussed before with many invasives. What is going to be the impact of climate change on their recovery? Those are really open questions that we know very little, if anything.
Well, we've never been through a climate change as extreme as it appears we're heading into now, so it's difficult to tell. We have been speaking with Dr. Andres Holz from Portland State University. He's the lead author of the new paper titled Southern Annular Mode Drives Multicentury Wildfire Activity in Southern South America, that was published at the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, or PNAS, in August 2017. You can find links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Andres, it's been such a pleasure talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. It was a pleasure for me as well.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Until the Industrial Revolution and the age of fossil power, humans did live sustainably because there was no other choice. Now this civilization seems headed off a series of cliffs, whether it's climate change, wiping out nature, or nuclear demise. Is there another choice, really? Maybe, says author John Michael Greer, we should steer toward the past. Greer is the author of at least 30 books. He deals with alternative lifestyles, ways of thinking, science fiction, a lot of things. His former blog, The Archdruid Report, has a huge following with a lively discussion area. Greer credits his online community as part inspiration for his new book, The Retro Future, Looking into the Past to Reinvent the Future. John Michael Greer, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on again.
Okay, so we can't even think of thoughts we need to discuss without first clearing a few mental landmines that block the way. And the first is often talked about, but few people get past it. Talk to us about the illusion, once again, of never-ending progress.
Oh, yeah. The thing is, you have to understand that progress is the established religion of the modern times. People believe in progress the way medieval peasants believed in the wonder-working bones of St. Ethelfrith. You know, progress is supposed to be omniscient, omnipotent, omnibenevolent. Of course, it's nothing of the kind. But so many people have so much of the hope stuck in this notion that there's this automatic slant to history that means that, well, maybe our lives suck, but in our grandchildren's or our great-grandchildren's time, they will live under they'll live in the perfect progressive utopia. It's nonsense, but like so many kinds of nonsense, people are very deeply emotionally attached to it. And so getting past that religious faith in progress, getting to the point where we realize that progress just means going further in the same direction you're already going, and that progress actually suffers from the same law of diminishing returns as everything else. The first breakthroughs are marvelous. The second breakthroughs are cool. The third ones are pretty good. The fourth, you know, by the time you're getting, you know, 200, 300, 400 years down the road, they're starting to lurch and it's starting to get pretty ugly. There is no rule that we have to keep on going in the same direction. There is no law of nature that requires us to keep on accepting worse and worse products, worse and worse lifestyles, worse and worse everything, just because, you know, some bozo at an ad agency labels it the latest heroic step in progress in man's march from the caves to the stars. It's religion.
But hang on, I'm pretty sure that an app will appear on my iPhone that will solve the energy problem.
I admire your faith. And in fact, that's just it. There have been a few things in recent years where there has been actual technological progress, and computer technology, and generally that the whole range of information technology has actually had some significant gains over the last few decades. Look at all the things that haven't. Your car is basically a piece of 1880s technology gussied up with a few microchips. Okay? Airplanes have not advanced significantly since the end of the Second World War. Most of the technology that actually fills our lives today, our grandparents used the same technologies or you know, were around when they arrived. And so it becomes this desperate clinging to faith in a faltering belief system, very much like the communism that I mocked there earlier. You know, people in the communist countries back in the day all, you know, were taught to believe that, you know, our grandchildren will live under communism, you know, the withering away of the state, the coming of the workers' utopia. And all the time, things actually got worse and worse and worse. We're in exactly the same situation now.
I worry the second illusion that you deal with in your second chapter is also, in a way, related to a problem with your book, though, and that is that humans can decide what's going to happen with our future. Can we really?
Well, to a certain extent, we can decide what will happen with our own personal futures, okay? You can actually choose what to. The main point that I made in that chapter is that you actually have a choice as to which technologies to use. You don't have to use whatever some ad agency wants to shove on you, what some marketer wants you to use. We have a range of choice. That doesn't mean we have absolute choice. Among other things, the Star Trek future, I don't care how much you want that, you're not going to get it. It's become painfully clear over the last 30, 40 years. That whole thing, the whole expansion across the galaxy, blah, 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 it's a pipe dream. And whatever they're putting in the pipes, you can have that if you want. But at any rate, we have some flexibility. We have some freedom. We can make choices. We can say, sure, I'll buy into the latest cheap, shoddy, ecologically devastating, loaded with nasty side effects technology, whatever it is. Or I could say, no, I think I'm going to keep what I have. Or worse still, the thing that I was using 10 years ago actually did a better job for less cost and had fewer side effects and problems. I think I'm going to go back to that.
Well, just like you, I'm tired of the green prophets who promise we can use renewable energy like solar or wind and never have to give up anything in our current lifestyles. We'll drive around in electric cars and feel good about it, or maybe everything will be powered by biofuels. Remember that one?
Oh, yeah. That's been going on since I was in high school. Biofuels, yes, we're going to use ethanol. Well, no, that doesn't work. That doesn't work. Let's try the next. They've gone through a whole cascade of things. The problem is the Earth doesn't absorb enough concentrated energy from the sun. Lots of diffuse energy, okay? Sunlight is not that hot. And so we don't have enough concentrated energy to run our kind of extremely hyper, super duper energy intensive, wasteful society. We can have a perfectly sensible, perfectly comfortable, perfectly viable, perfectly humane society on a lot less energy than we have now, but we're going to have to get rid of a whole range of energy-wasting habits.
Yeah, I'm going for bicycles myself. I think that's the way to go. I've got a cargo bike, and that means I can pick up my groceries, I can carry around a kid or anything I want with it. Don't need the car.
Exactly. A bicycle is a really good way. The technology that I tend to use to get around is called shoe leather. And that's, it works for me very well. I the neighborhood where I live right now is it's convenient. I can get to places and so on. Of course, getting to places may involve walking a mile, but hey, that's my healthcare plan, okay?
Yeah. Your new book, it's just loaded with powerful phrases like this one. A great many people these days seem to have lost the ability to grasp that the other side can learn. And you were talking first about foreign policy, and I kind of jumped ahead of you and thought, well, yeah, but what about parasites and bacteria and all that? What if an intelligent nature decides we're just an interesting experiment, but we're too dangerous to allow to continue?
Or whether nature chooses that, some virus or bacteria just says, ooh, look at the dinner menu. The thing is, we have this fantasy, and this is like the religion of progress. It's like this fantasy of perpetual progress, okay? The notion that human beings are the only things who can actually change anything. If anything happens in the world, it must be some human being that's doing it. Nature can't do anything by itself. Nothing else can do anything by itself. We are history's actors. That was Karl Rove's delusional line back a few presidencies. And of course, we know how well that worked for him. The fact is, when we start dumping pesticides on our fields, we just set up the situation so that any plant that can evolve around those pesticides has its open season. Any weed, any bug, any plant fungus, it's field day for evolution in this situation. We've lost track of the fact that if we act, other things can react, and they may not react the way we want them to. Half of what's going wrong in our society today is precisely this stupid notion that we can just do whatever we want and nothing will happen. Nature will just sit there. Sorry.
I'm afraid that you've poked away at one of my sacred cows. You say that science may change away from institutional academia, but I have to say that many of the brilliant scientists I've interviewed on Radio EcoShock come from that institutional or modeling environment. I don't think that's done yet.
Well, it may not be done in the sense of there are still things that institutional science can discover. The problem is institutional science going to retain the funding? Is it going to retain the social prestige? Is it going to retain the institutional support that enables it to do those kind of things? Now, at this point, when, every week some scientist comes on and says, you remember all that stuff that we told you last week about cholesterol or whatever it is? Well, it was all wrong.
That happens over and over again.
It happens. And every time that happens, the people outside the scientific community are looking up with their beady eyes and saying, okay, so why should we believe you this time? And the thing is, they're right to ask that question. Because so much of science these days is corrupt. So much of it is bought and paid for by corporate interests. So much of it is bought and paid for by political interests. What was once one of the grandest achievements of the human mind has become just another marketing department for various commercial interests and political ideologies. And people know that. People are aware of it. And that's why when some bozo in a white lab coat gets up in front of you and says, okay, everything you knew was wrong, here's what you should believe, a growing number of people just look at that and say, okay, why should we trust you? Give me a reason. And the guys in the white lab coats do not handle that well.
So, John Michael Greer, is it true you don't have a television, and how can you live like that?
Well, it is in fact quite true that I don't have a television. I have not had a television in my adult life. And as for how I can live with that, well, you know, here's a secret. Before the 1950s, everybody on the planet lived without a television. You know, they actually seem to have gotten along just fine. Not only that, they got a lot more done than most people get nowadays when they spend 4 to 6 hours a day, you know, with drool puddling on their laps as they sit there watching the Idiot Bugs. I constantly get people asking me, how do you find the time to write all these books and do this and do that and do the other things? And my answer is very simple. I don't have a television. I have a life instead.
What a concept. I'm sort of worrying that some of the retro movements may be drawing on that same demon of nostalgia that powered Donald Trump into the presidency, saying, go backwards in time and make America great again. Maybe nostalgia is one of the drugs that is poisoning our brains. How would you avoid that?
Well, the first thing, we could get have a long talk about a lot of what drove the whole Donald Trump phenomenon. Many of our listeners may know, I actually predicted his election in January of 2016, most of a year before it happened. And it's not just nostalgia. There were a lot of failures on the part of the existing political system that basically opened the door to what's happened. But the thing is, nostalgia for the sake of nostalgia is a bad idea. What we need is the idea that we can look at the past and the present, all the available options, and say, okay, which one of these actually serves our purpose? So it's not a matter of wholesalely embracing any particular part of the past, much less a sort of imaginary past of the kind that so many people put their minds to these days. It's a matter of just taking the past as a smorgasbord, taking the past and the present, and say, okay, I want one of these, I want two of those, I'm going to take a scoop of this, and mixing them together and see what works. You're not supposed to do that, by the way. That's a total taboo in today's society. You're supposed to just take whatever the nice man on the television wants you to buy. That's not a sane option these days. That's not a survivable option these days. So, you know, come check out the smorgasbord. Come pick up some things and try this and try that and see what works for you personally instead of what works for some Wall Street executive who's trying to shove this stuff down your throat.
I'm aware of several attempts in history to go back to a golden age. The Chaldeans tried to go back to the script and social system of Babylonia. And then all through European history, there have been a series of reclamations of the new Roman Empire. But it was really always something new.
And exactly. And in fact, if we do a retro future, if in fact people, realizing that a lot of what we have, what the latest offerings of products are junk, go back to older technologies and older things, it's not going to be going back to some kind of past situation. They're going to do something new with it. An example that I really like these days, typewriters are coming back in. They're being used by artists and poets as performance piece instruments. And there are all kinds of new things being done, things that nobody would have ever thought to do with a typewriter back in the day when everyone typed with one. So you see, going back is a way, it just becomes a springboard to go forward in a different direction. Remember, progress just means going forward the same way you're going. If you're going off a cliff, that's not a good idea. Go 90 degrees to one side. Go any place. The world is much more three-dimensional. It's not just this straight line going, again, the way some corporate jerk wants you to go.
What do you think of the many predictions that artificial intelligence will replace most of the current workforce, creating a new class of poverty?
They've been saying that since before I was born. It was always going to happen 10 years from now. Seriously, in 1960, they were saying by 1970, 85% of all jobs in America will be replaced by robots. The secret, of course, is that as our economy winds down, as the vast, you know, attempting to prop up an economy that was once propped up by cheap fossil fuels on an endless supply of debt. As that breaks down, a lot of jobs are going away. It's not a matter of people being replaced by robots. It's a matter of an economy coming unglued and people having to step down toward other ways of making a living that don't necessarily feed the pockets of the rich. It's very, very convenient for people who don't want to look at the end of progress to say, oh, no, all this unemployment, it's because of robots, it's because of AI. We have to focus on this idea of progress ever into the future. It's falling dead at our feet. Right now, the great god progress, you know, remember Nietzsche said God is dead. We need a new Nietzsche to say progress is dead. Okay? No, there's no heartbeat. There's no pulse. It's lying there, twitching in front of us. Let's do something else.
I'm Alex Smith with my guest, author and historian of ideas, John Michael Greer. This is Radio EcoShock. You've covered in a previous work another way out, which is collapse now and avoid the rush. Which book do you recommend for that?
That one would probably be The Ecotechnic Future.
Okay. And let's say we need to go back to a time when technology was sustainable, as you suggest. How far back might that be?
It's almost impossible to say because we're not going back to a single time. Again, the smorgasbord approach is what we have to have in mind. We can pick one thing here and one thing there, something from 1950 and something from 1920 and something from 1850 and something from the Bronze Age, if that works. It's not a matter of going back to a specific time because history is not a straight line. It's a smorgasbord. You can pick what you want, assemble it. There's something that people used to talk about, bricolage, the habit of just picking and choosing and putting stuff together like a mosaic. We need a technological bricolage right now. We need to take that approach toward our technology rather than just thinking that, you know, that just because you use a steam engine, you have to wear a Victorian top hat.
In the early 1980s, my wife and I spent 10 years living without electricity. We didn't have a phone or any services. It was a great time, but it helped us to be young and strong. And I'm not sure that works for seniors or people with health problems. What is your advice for people thinking of unplugging?
The thing to do is look at what you actually need and distinguish that from what you've simply gotten used to. And also, you don't have to do it whole hog. Again, smorgasbord. Pick and choose. Decide, okay, you know, I think I need to have this technology so I can get in touch with my doctor or so I can do this or that or the other. But these other technologies, I don't need them. And in fact, I don't want them. They bore me. So I'm not going to do them. And if people say, well, you have to have that, you can tell them to get stuffed. You don't have to do it whole hog. You don't have to go completely off the grid, unless you want to, in which case, by all means. But pick and choose. Remember, the heresy of technological choice is the thing I'm trying to talk about here. And it is a heresy. Believers in the religion of progress shriek and clutch their pearls or their neckties. Take your choice when you mention it. But yeah, you can choose what technologies you want. Go ahead, pick and choose. Chuck the ones that don't meet your needs. And take a hard look at the ones that you think you need and say, okay, do I actually need this or am I just fooling myself? Is it just something that's wasting my time, you know, eating my brain, and I could get much more done without it?
Millions of people in North America and Europe are clueless about how dependent they are on the fossil fuel system until a fire, an earthquake, or a flood disconnects them, and then 3 days and riots break out. Talk to us about system dependency, John Michael Greer.
Oh, yeah. Basically, most people in modern industrial society are horribly vulnerable, and they're vulnerable because they depend on these vast, sprawling technosystems. It all seems very convenient, as you say, until something breaks down, and things are breaking down more and more often. As the global economy declines, as we run further and further into the depletion of fossil fuels and non-renewable resources, those breakdowns are going to become more and more frequent. On the one hand, the more things you can do without, the safer you are, the easier it's going to be to take care of yourselves and your loved ones. On the other hand, to the extent that you could do without this stuff, you're going to free up space for people who actually do need it. So it becomes very much a matter of, what do you actually need? And then are there ways you can get it that don't involve being dependent on some vast, sprawling bureaucratic monstrosity that could be taken out by, you know, a 50-cent fuse blowing 500 miles from you?
So you do have some concrete proposals of technologies that could survive our current civilization. You talk about seven of them, for example. Would you talk about just a couple so we get the idea?
Okay, here's one example. Radio. In every community in the United States, in Europe, in most of the world, in fact, amateur radio used to be a really big thing. Now it's kind of an odd little hobby. But these are people who build, in many cases, they build their own radio equipment. They can, you know, communicate across the planet using a very little electricity and simple gear, the kind of things people were using in the 1950s and the 1920s. And so that's a technology that could survive for the very long term. And it's a technology that's extremely useful right now. Whenever there's a natural disaster, the hurricanes that we've had in Florida and Texas right now, immediately, as soon as that happened, all the ham radio people were getting out there, you know, basically digging themselves out of the rubble, getting an antenna up, firing up their things, and opening and setting up a communications net. That's incredibly important, and that's something that could survive our civilization entirely because, again, you can make this stuff out of some fairly simple material. Another example, and one that's very dear to my heart, is the printing press. One of the things we know about Dark Ages, about what happens when a civilization crashes, if they've got printing, your recovery is much quicker. It's much less problematic, much less traumatic, because you can mass produce documents. In China, in Japan, they've had several Dark Ages over the last couple of millennia, and they were using woodblock printing. It's a very simple technology. But they could mass produce documents that way. In Europe during the last Dark Age there, they didn't have a printing press until they figured out how to do printing. And every manuscript, every document had to be copied by hand. That really slowed things up. If people can get into printing now, get into just simple hand-operated printing presses, and pass that technology on, that could go straight through whatever the future has to throw at us, and make it much easier for us to recover in the future. Those are two very simple examples, but they're things that anybody can contribute to.
You know, I had a printing press a few years ago myself, and you have to get used to typesetting the letters backwards, but that's another problem. You know, I love it that in this age of computers and prepackaged thought and TV talk shows, you are calling for, quote, a revival of the skills of thinking. Is it too late?
No. The great thing about the human brain is that you can actually learn. You don't have to wait for some, vast corporation to provide you with an upgrade. You can just, start thinking. Not only that, a lot of the basic skills of this were worked out 2,000, 3,000 years ago. So most of the bugs are out of the programming at this point. So all you have to do is just start asking yourself hard questions like, how do I know that that's true? And if that were true, then what else would be true so I can check it? And, what are some of the basic logical fallacies? This was worked out by the ancient Greeks. What are the kinds of arguments that people go to when they're lying through their teeth? You can identify that, oh, that's an ad hominem argument. I remember that one. You are full of So it's not that difficult. It's really easy. Well, every human being that has a functional brain has the capacity to make use of this very, very ancient, very effective tool set. And the amount of annoyance that causes to politicians and marketers, that's just lining up. That's fun. That adds to the fun.
Here's the type of thinking and the type of sentence that brings down critics howling on John Michael Greer. You say, if there's such a thing as a natural human society, the basic Dark Age society is probably it. Why would you say that?
Well, when you look at history, every society starts out in about the same place. If you take Dark Age European society and Dark Age Japanese society, the bottom of the Sengoku Jidai of the samurai period, if you take Dark Age Greek society before classical Greece started going and so on, they're all basically running the same thing. They've all got, the heroic mythos. They've got a kind of proto-feudal social structure. You could, Gilgamesh and Beowulf could swap monsters and nobody would notice the difference. As a society develops, it becomes more and more differentiated. It goes its own way. It develops its own unique ways of approaching all the various problems that human societies have to deal with. And so it becomes more and more differentiated. So, while in feudal Greece and feudal England were very similar, by the time you get to the Greek Renaissance and the English Renaissance, they're completely different. And classical Greece and modern England, almost nothing in common. Then the civilization runs itself into the ground. All the usual problems crop up. They burn through their resource base. They destroy their environmental basis. They slam face first into the usual problems and go tumbling back down to another Dark Age society. We don't like to think of history as going in cycles, but it is as predictable as the human life cycle. Okay, we're all born. We grow up. A assuming we live to grow up. We hit puberty. We go through the usual convulsions of puberty. We mature. We get old. We die. So do civilizations in a very similar pattern. You can, if you look through history, you'll watch it again and again with the same kind of landmarks on the way. And so getting past the fantasy that says, no, no, we're different. We're going to live forever. We, you know, we're going to go zooming off to the stars and nothing will ever change for us again. That's nonsense.
But hold on. You think we're in a cycle of time and of history, though, and so you wouldn't agree with Dr. Guy McPherson when he says that near-term human extinction is facing us due to climate change.
He's been predicting that for years. In 2009, he was saying that by 2012, there would be no longer any cars on the road because we'd be all out of oil. Yeah, you know, I appreciate his sincerity and his honesty, but he really needs to study some history and to get an idea of the extent to which we're simply following a familiar pattern.
Have you seen any signs that the retro future you write about is already trying to be born?
Yeah. Right now, for example, sales of electronic books, e-books, are actually declining steadily, whereas sales of printed books are going up again. One of the big social changes in large parts of the English-speaking world these days is people are ditching their smartphones and going back to old-fashioned flip phones or even, heaven help us, landlines. I'm on a landline right now. I don't use a cell phone, by the way. There's a broad awareness that a lot of the things that were done 50 and 100 years ago simply produce better results than the stuff, the equivalent things you get nowadays. And you've started to get people starting to cash in on that. People started looking at it and saying, you know, if I produce something using these old techniques, everyone's going to go, oh, that's higher quality. I'm willing to pay a little extra for that. And so we're actually starting to see a movement in a lot of different fields toward a kind of retro culture, a kind of retro technology, by people who simply want something that's good rather than something that's progressive.
We've been talking with the prolific author and blogger John Michael Greer. I just finished his book, and I found it very stimulating. I took a lot of notes, a lot more than we can get into today. His new book is The Retro Future, Looking into the Past to Reinvent the Future. And you can find John Michael's new blog at www.ecosophia.net. And there's links to some of his works in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Is there anything you'd like to add as we wrap up, John Michael Greer?
I'd like to encourage everybody to look at the technology in their lives and say, do I actually want this?
It's been a pleasure having you on Radio EcoShock again.
Radio EcoShock.
John Michael Greer says, history is not a straight line. It's a smorgasbord of choices. We can pick this and that. I'm wondering if history is more like an interdependent ecosystem. Is it possible to remove one piece of technology without the surrounding system of that time? For example, the bricolage technique of selection of weapons, who will choose swords when technology of guns is still known, much less missiles and nuclear weapons? Will steam make a comeback? Will horses return as our transportation? He mentions getting in touch with a doctor. Will we go back from medical discoveries? Perhaps we keep those in our smorgasbord, but that means high technology like blood analysis, CT scans, and all that. It takes some form of industrial base to provide those tools at scale. When we pick one item or one field from the present, maybe that tends to rebuild the whole system again. Still, it's clear what Greer is talking about. We don't have to accept every new technology simply because it's being hyped. Choice of technology is a right, or it should be. And people who techno-shame or techno-bully, you know, your TV is so small, your phone is so old, that needs to end. At a deeper level, when you read the book, John Michael Greer is also looking at the long haul. One of his 7 sustainable technologies is intensive organic gardening. We all know fossil fuels and all the chemicals and pesticides made from them will not go on forever. Eventually, those things run out, and perhaps the intensive industrial system that made them will perish as well. Humans, if there are humans, will be doing intensive organic gardening partly because there will be no other choice. Realizing that all civilizations are waves in time which crest and then fall away, maybe we can prepare for the next stage with intelligent choices for a retro future. That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. I've got two top scientists lined up for next week as we explore extreme climate changes and maybe another way out. I'm Alex Smith, your dedicated nonprofit broadcaster. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
And we're back. It's the Taylor Report, and we're getting a chance now to speak to Ted Schmidt. He's the author of The Season, when the 1967 Mimico Marauders dominated Toronto high school basketball. Ted Schmidt is a former editor of the Catholic New Times and a Toronto-based research teacher and writer. He's the author of four books, Shabbos Goy, A Catholic Boyhood on a Jewish Street in Protestant Toronto, Journeys to the Heart of Catholicism, Never Neutral, A Teaching Life, and I Was a Catholic Zionist. And Ted Schmidt is with us. Welcome to the show, Ted. It's good to see you.
Great to be back, Phil.
This is I get a kick out of this book because show me the person who actually doesn't have some interest in sports and or hasn't tried it and wanted to be an athlete. And I mean, I'm talking about men and women who wanted to be. And so we hear of a book about success at a game, and we say, maybe I could get a tip there. Maybe I'm going to learn something. And so I dipped into the book and finished it happily, and it discovered that it's a book about how to win, which I wanted to learn, of course, and about a bunch of wonderful people. But it's also a meditation about why people come together, how you keep them together, make a community, and how that might be a secret ingredient in your success as a coach. So let's start with that. Is that so?
Yeah, I always ask the question, what am I doing here? First of all, I was a teacher, and one of my mantras was, it's kind of a said in a facetious way, don't call me coach, I'm a teacher. I teach on baseball diamonds, I teach on hardwood floors, and latterly I teach on picket lines. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask the question, and you're right, I think it's a spiritual, it's a meditative book on why do people coach? What are they doing, particularly in a high school setting? So remember in the book I write about two guys whose names I changed, Smith and whatever his name was, who were deeply offended that the championship game didn't go off because of a teacher strike, and they said, we wasted 300 hours. I said, well, what do you mean? You know, I thought you wasted 300 hours. What about this precious time that you had with young people? Did that go for nothing? What are you doing out there? What kind of a teacher are you? So these were the questions. So many years I coached up at a basketball camp called Camp Olympia. And Dave Grace, who started the camp, when he started, he looked around for what he thought were the best coaches in Ontario to get the camp off to a good start. So he invited me up, and every year we came for 1 week, same week, 15 coaches, same week. For many years. So I got to know the coach at York University, Bob Bain, and he said, I'm really interested in your approach to coaching. Would you come up and talk in my class about what you do? So I said, well, sure, I'll come up. And I really broke it down to two words, being a classics man, techne and logos. I says, every teacher has techne, which is the Greek word for art or skill. You know, we're going to teach you how to pick and roll, you know, the mechanics of a jump shot.
Listen closely.
Yeah, most of us can do that. But logos, that's the second part of the word technology. And that really is a Greek word meaning, what is the meaning of what you're doing? What is the inner disposition of the person that you're coaching? So I had a teacher when I studied theology in England who asked, what do you need to teach Sanskrit to Gopal? Do you need to know Sanskrit or do you need to know Gopal? Well, the answer as a teacher is you need to know both. You need to know the Sanskrit or the subject that you're teaching, but you better know Gopal, the student who's in front of you. So, you know, that was what I would
do. Was your teacher Donald Nichols?
Donald Nichol.
Yeah. That was your teacher?
That was the teacher.
Ted Schmidt was taught by Donald.
Donald Nichol was a great philosopher.
And look him up. Books.
So I thought I just tried to break it down. And I told a story there about a wonderful player I had the following year after this great team, Freddie Dimpson. And I had to use him because it was a small school. And Fred had 2 more years of junior. Mm-hmm. But he turned out to be such an incredible shooter and went on to play university ball. But I said, I knew the family. They were friends of mine. And during that season, Fred's a wonderful mother died. And I looked out into the audience, and there was a woman who was smiling. And, you know, as a speaker, mm-hmm. I'm used to looking at audiences. And I said, my God, is that you, Lita? And it was Fred's sister. And she kind of had a smile, but a tear. I was talking about her mother, who had died. And she smiled. She said, keep going. She just loved it. My point being, these were people I knew, and I knew them really well. I was a single guy. Mm-hmm. I had time to get into people's lives. Mm-hmm. As you read the book, you found out how important the meals were that I had.
Breaking bread.
Yeah.
A very important matter.
Well, I think so. And I wasn't trying to tell.
Isn't this about neighbors and friends, et cetera? You have to break bread.
Yeah, you do. You have to sit down. And I remember at Mimico as a young teacher, it was a very old staff. And when I would go out and sit with students, one teacher called me a barbarian. It's like, you don't do that. You know, but when you go and sit down with other people who are supposedly your inferiors, like students, I'm a teacher.
Yes.
You know, but I said, no. I want to break any idea that there's a separation between me and the students. So Friday night, as many of the students mentioned, we would go up to George's Spaghetti House, and we'd hardly ever talk about basketball.
By the way, this book is a great advertisement for that Spaghetti House. I've been thinking about it ever since I read the book.
Well, the meal was the important thing because I realized that a meal, something special happens. Mm. You know, people drop their guards and they begin to speak to you.
But they can ask you stuff, right?
They can ask you stuff.
As you know, a kid in the classroom is terrified of being laughed at.
That's right.
And that it takes something very – some way to break the wall.
That's right.
And so – and by the way, to me, the coaches – I played a lot of sports. The coach was one I sort of always hoped, here's a guy maybe I could talk to because he's more involved with you. He's yelling at you. He's pulling on you.
Yeah.
He's talking. But there's also time where you can say, do you want me to do this or that? And you can tell whether he's a human being who's going to respond to you.
That's right.
And later you go to him with, you have a problem.
You know, one of the things that really struck me when I asked the players on that team 50 years ago now to write their memories. Mm-hmm. And they all mentioned this idea, as you know if you read the book, about the meal. And one wonderful player, Gary Balog, who wrote this. I'll never forget, you came to my house on February 22nd. I said, how the hell would he remember the date? But I kept a journal in those years. I went back, and there it was. I said, well, the only reason he would have mentioned it, and he mentioned the wonderful conversation I had with his parents. Here's the teacher coming to my house. This was unheard of.
Absolutely.
Well, I didn't think anything about it because I was a single guy, and I made myself available. Any students that would invite me to, you know, a dance or whatever, I'd go.
Yes.
Because I wanted to be available.
If this is amazing. You gave people, your players, J.D. Salinger, Franny and Zooey.
Yeah.
And then you would use, you're coaching them and you're saying, now you remember when the character in the book and the story says so-and-so. And they say, oh, yeah, now I get it. You know.
Well, they were always students, you know, and I give them books. And
Salinger, good for you.
Oh, sure. I mean, I
there's a World War II veteran, by the way. People have to understand that, man.
That's right. No, I was a big fan.
His daughter said, you know, why was he a loner and all that? And she said he'd kept – one thing she said, I'll never forget, he told me he couldn't get the smell of burning human flesh out of his nose.
Yeah. Salinger was very big in those years about what it was to be a teenager, you know, the Catcher in the Rye. Yeah. So I'd be handing books out all the time and to some of the players. But I think one of the things that changed me was I had gone to St. Mike's High School. Mm-hmm. And it was Hockey Haven. You know, this was the most famous school in Canada, turning out hockey players left, right, and center, and my classmate, Frank Mihalovic, et cetera. So I resented the way those players were treated. You know, there was a great a sports writer in New York named Stanley Woodward, mm-hmm. who always told young sports writers, don't god these people up. They're just human beings like you. Yeah. And most of the guys I knew at St. Mike's, they were very decent guys. But so then I had read this incredible book called Sports World by Robert Lipsight. Lipsight was this phenomenal New Yorker who wrote about Sports World. This is just a quote of his. Sports World is a gross distortion of sports. It has limited the pleasure of play for most while concentrating on turning our best athletes into clowns. It has made the finish more important than the race. Mm-hmm. By the end of the 60s, sports world wisdom had it that religion was a spectator sport, while professional and college athletic contests were the only events we held sacred. So sports world, I resented. Sports world totally encased people inside that bubble. And I use the example, suppose my classmate Frank Mihalovic St. Mike's was seen in 1970 with me out at Bloor and Young speaking out against apartheid. Mm-hmm. People's head would explode because he was out of the context, you know. And I use the example of the young phenom Austin Matthews. What if he was seen in front of the Israeli consulate protesting against apartheid? 20 people couldn't handle it. They said, what the hell is he doing there?
Short answer, he wouldn't be seen again.
He wouldn't be seen again. The coaches would say, what the hell are you doing? So many of these people never developed as human beings. You know, they were always gotted up by people looking for celebrity status.
You have a great quote, I think, is Martin Luther King saying that when you're silent about something, you begin to die.
That's right. And I never wanted to be silent. And when two of my friends who broke out of Sports World, and I love them. They were lovely people. Carl Brewer, who just said, well, there's more to life. I remember he wrote me when he broke away from Little Napoleon, Punch Imlach, because he couldn't take him. And he said, here are you teaching kids, and I'm chasing a rubber disc around you know, the rink. Yeah. And here's Carl, who didn't need to get involved in the broken down athletes, which he did, and he brought Eagleson to...
Listen, you're right. He did the world a big service.
Tremendous. He broke out of Sports
World. And did that take guts?
It took a lot of guts. And my other friend, Pat Hannigan, who I had the honor of eulogizing, was an NHL hockey player. Three of them made the NHL. Pat had this conversion experience by going to Nicaragua and seeing the poverty and came back and said to his wonderful wife, Lynn, we have to change. There's more to life. Mm. And they opened a refugee house in Fort Erie, people streaming across from Buffalo. And they were absolutely incredible. But he gave up the celebrity, he gave up the idea that, oh, yeah, I played in the NHL. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a citizen. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a caring human being. Mm-hmm. So
we're talking to Ted Schmidt, and the book is The Season. You can go to info@bookband. If I get that right.
.com.
Info. Oh. Bookband.com to get a copy of the book, and it'll be distributed. I'm predicting it'll be at a different book list.
Yeah, it's now at the Beaches bookstore.
That's not fair. It shouldn't just be in the Beaches.
No,
it's a very competitive city.
We really haven't launched it yet. I'm waiting to go back to Mimico probably in November to bring it out.
Well, so we have to contrast. And I have to tell you, Ted, this tears me a little because on the one hand, you point out this is fun. You made the game fun.
Yeah.
But you worked them to death.
Yeah.
But it was fun.
Yeah.
And you talk about how important that is spiritually. You're free when you're having fun. a person's mind is free. It's a creative moment to be that way. But you also run into the blizzard of capitalist sport, monopoly sport. We read today the Calgary Flames said, "Give us all these things, or we will leave your city." And, you know, I mean, this is brutal. So in a sense, you seem to say almost, I think I should walk away from sport. But we don't want you to do that. You're a great coach. But also, you noticed how much fun sport is.
Well, you need to demand.
You have to resell me on the sport.
We only had seven players. So they had to be in the best shape
possible. By the way, does Mimico play basketball now?
I think so. But there's no Mimico High School. It's gone. Yeah. There's only one school on the Lakeshore. But we had to be very disciplined because we only had seven players. They never saw full court press. They never saw this in Toronto.
You do read to me like Johnny Wooden.
Well, it was fun.
Those guys have to be able to run. The style of basketball you played,
that's right.
You have to be in condition because the fourth quarter is when it's going to be decided.
And they were very disciplined players. I asked a lot of them, and it was fun watching them. You know, I used to laugh. It was just great. And I'd made friends with kids on the other team.
Some of them write in this book. Some very nice, you have some very nice little segments written by your former players.
Well, it wouldn't be a book without the six players. One died that made the team up. I said, it's your book. Tell me what you remember 50 years ago. But it's also a hymn to this wonderful working class community of Mimico that was really looked down upon by North Etobicoke, et cetera, you know, because it was the industrial heart of Canada, and most of the kids I taught, their parents, you know, worked in factories, et cetera. But it was an extraordinary place to teach. I would have stayed there, not gone into the Catholic system, had there been work for me as a guidance counselor. But Vatican II hit, and I said, well, maybe I should be over in the Catholic
system. You're a reformer. I really liked your thinking, and I know you've gone after the subject, and I want our listeners to hear this point. Today's page one, they're talking about concussions. You said get rid of football.
Yeah, and I coached one year with the Argonaut player who was a place kicker and was traded out west for Jackie Parker, Bill Mitchell. Bill Mitchell was a good friend of mine. We coached together.
Well, I'm glad we got Jackie Parker.
Yeah, I got sick of watching 120-pound kids in junior, you know, where their neck's not formed, go up against 180-pound kids.
That's dangerous.
And then when I went to Neil McNeil High School, I said, this game is for savages. By 1979, I wrote
That's not good salesmanship. No, I get your point.
I wrote, it's time for Catholic schools to get out of football. I said, here we are talking about a nonviolent hero, Jesus. And I says, we're asking people to crush people out there.
Yes.
And it was just too violent. And, I got some nice hate letters from all over the province. But it turned out, I guess I was there before everybody else because football's dying of its own up here. Parents are not allowing their kids to go in because we know what happens when, you know, the immovable object meets the et cetera, et cetera.
They certainly, if we have to face it, this has been going on. I can recall when everybody agreed at one time they were going to get rid of, it was Kefauver was his name, a man from Kentucky, a senator.
Yes, this Kefauver.
He was going to get rid of boxing.
Oh, we should
have. Everybody said, of course. But then you said, well, listen, in football you can get hit a lot harder.
That's right.
And it'll break your neck.
Yeah, so it's dying. I was going to go up to my old school board, the Catholic board, and say, you should be canning every team that has, but it's dying. Mm-hmm. I think there's only about four or five schools that have it anymore because of immigration. They're all playing soccer. They're playing rugby. Okay, you can get hurt in rugby, but there's no head-on tackling with a helmet like you have.
Yes.
You can't make football
safe. A high-speed collision.
You cannot make football safe.
Yeah.
So luckily I got out of it, and then...
Hey, by the way, you broke your jaw. I can tell our listeners.
Well,
little detail.
Well, don't bring that up. When I played at university, right here at the University of Toronto, I broke my jaw. That had nothing to do with it. I mean, I was silly 20-year-old
kid.
Yeah,
you just put your head where it shouldn't have been,
and
a guy kicked you.
I got kicked there, but no, I was a big football fan. But then you begin to think about, what are you doing? What is life about?
Yeah, but play, I mean, I got to keep coming back. You sell me on play at the
yeah.
beginning of this of the book.
Yeah, I talk and, about
and,
play.
And you do talk about how important it is that somehow, even for teaching, right, that you're not in a frightened environment,
right,
or one where you're constricted and waiting, yeah, for the word to come down.
Right.
But there's just that space,
right,
where you're working on something together.
Right.
And it becomes enjoyable.
Whether it's basketball
or you benefit.
Or in the class.
Yeah.
So I used the Dutch theorist Johan Huizinga, who talked about play. I mean, he had brilliant ideas about what play is, that life is really meaningless unless you learn how to play.
Huizinga, is that?
Huizinga, yeah. H-U-I-Z-E-N-G-A.
I was waiting for you to come in so that I could hear it pronounced properly.
Yeah.
Homo Ludens.
Yeah, and he wrote the book Man the Player. Homo, mm-hmm, Ludens, from my Latin, you know, man essentially should learn to play. We had so much fun. And when Don Shabib came to do that movie on our team that you can still see on YouTube.
This is Don Shabib of Going Down the Road.
Going Down the Road. Just plug in Mimico Basketball. You see this team 50 years ago. And I have only seen that play a movie once or twice, but I looked and said the fun that we would have, because at the end, since we only had eight players, I had to dress in scrimmage with them. Mm-hmm. And I would mock the hell out of them, you know. And by the time they got to senior, they were much better players than I was. But we had a lot of fun. And it was great to watch these guys, you know, listen to my barking out Cato or Brutus, my Latin names for the different presses.
Yeah, and they remember this.
Well, they all remembered them, eh? Well, we had the athletes to do it.
You come from a Latin-trained family.
Yes, I did. My mother was a Latin teacher, and I was a classics teacher. So I used that.
You don't expect to find you guys on the basketball court. I'm not surprised you did well.
No, you wouldn't expect that. But
but you quote Nietzsche saying that man is at his best when he's playing. I mean, when he can be what he was happy,
yeah,
like as a child.
At play.
That's when he's best.
Yeah, yeah. Man's maturity, you know, to get back to when he was a child at play. We had so much fun. It was never a problem with this team. I just couldn't believe we kept winning. And you'd enjoy it, and it was just marvelous.
This is Ted Schmidt. Before we go further, I remind you, the book is The Season, Ted Schmidt, and info@bookband.com to get a copy.
It's only $15, and they'll send it right to your door.
It's great. It's got a picture of Ted stealing a basketball net on the front.
Yeah,
which is
it's a really, tournament.
Talk about corrupting youth, Socrates. This is how you do it. they're actually helping their coach steal a net.
Well, you did that.
And a trophy.
You cut the net down. I didn't know this tradition, but they all raised me
up.
They
picked you up.
They gave me scissors, and I still have parts of the net.
Yeah. And this is a coach who still to this day is in close touch with his champions.
Well, Don Crocker and Larry Trafford, two of my great guards, said to me, "Hey, Ted," because they were still good friends. It's 50 years ago that we should get together. I said, yeah, like I don't live in the past. But I said, and Donnie quoted Fred Shero. It was a beautiful quote. You win tonight, the old hockey coach Fred Shero, you win tonight and you walk with these people the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. There was a relationship there that was profound. Yes. It was just incredible, the friendship. Well, you know, you win 45 games, you lose one.
Yeah.
We were just an extraordinary team, you know.
By the way, I get you to comment on the Kaepernick phenomenon. You must find this
absolutely
an act of considerable political significance. I mean, a man who foregoes great money and takes a stand, and it's like a ripple. A lot of black athletes
money.
And white athletes are starting to take a knee or to turn their change.
He broke out of sports world like Carlos and Smith in 1968. We're citizens. Before we're athletes, you know. And then when I left Mimico, I became a lot more political. You know, I used to take my basketball team at Neil down to protest with Dan Heap against the grape strike, you know, for Cesar Chavez. I said, we got better things to do than coach basketball.
But that would make them closer. I mean, the beauty of it is you're not doing anything insidious, but you actually are making them feel more grounded. They're not just a bunch of kids playing a game.
Well, it was relationships. People grow through sport. Sport has a lot to offer people, eh? The dedication.
That's what I wanted to hear you say.
The commitment. But sports world, you can forego that. Sports, wonderful. We can all enjoy
sports. Sports business world.
Yeah.
Corporate sport.
Absolutely.
Well, we've been talking to the great Ted Schmidt. The book is The Season. And go to infobookband.com.
That's right. And they'll send it to you. $15.
$15. And, well, boy, it's been a pleasure. We've got to have you come back. There's a bunch of other things about sport we've got to talk about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's been great.
So thanks very much. And I think we got, what's his name, Johnny?
Johnny Fogarty.
Johnny Fogarty.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present investigative journalist and author Greg Palast, who examines what he believes to be the true mission of Donald Trump's Election Integrity Commission. Drew Spencer Penrose of the group Fair Vote, who talks about the importance of a case challenging partisan gerrymandering that will soon be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. And DACA recipient Eric Cruz Lopez and immigration attorney Joanne Lewis, who address key issues in the debate on the future of DACA at a recent hearing in New Haven, Connecticut. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Under growing criticism for the brutal ethnic cleansing targeting Myanmar's Muslim minority, the country's leader and Nobel Prize winner, Aung San Suu Kyi, canceled plans to go to the United Nations General Assembly meeting in New York City. Since late August, Suu Kyi has remained silent on the military offensive against the Muslim Rohingya minority, who have no citizen rights in Myanmar, a majority Buddhist nation. In response to the Rohingya insurgency's assault on several army posts, Myanmar's army attacked and burned Rohingya villages, forcing over 400,000 Rohingya to flee to Bangladesh. The UN Human Rights Commission has accused Myanmar of engaging in a textbook case of ethnic cleansing, and leaders of Muslim nations have accused Myanmar of committing acts of genocide. Responding to the violence, nearly 500,000 people signed a petition calling on the Nobel Prize Committee to strip Suu Kyi of her Peace Prize. Numerous Peace Prize winners, including Malala Yousafzai, Iranian lawyer Shirin Ebadi, and South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu, have criticized Suu Kyi. Tutu, who won the 1984 Peace Prize for his opposition to the racist apartheid regime, declared, "If the political price for your ascension to the highest office in Myanmar is your silence, the price is surely too steep." Amid the ongoing debate over the future of the U.S. healthcare system, a new battle is brewing in the courts over drug prices. An important set of lawsuits targets one of the biggest reasons for high prices, the middlemen that manipulate the pharmaceutical supply chain by extracting profits at every turn. Eventually, the price gouging gets passed down to consumers. The middlemen, known as pharmacy benefit managers, administer drug benefits for health plans and claim to negotiate the lowest prescription drug prices directly with manufacturers and pharmacies. The lawsuit, however, charges that the PBMs are putting their own profits first and sticking consumers with the bill. A class action suit against CVS claims the pharmacy charged one plaintiff $165.68 for a generic drug that would have cost only $92 if she had paid out of pocket. Pharmacy benefits managers often impose a gag rule preventing pharmacists from discussing the true cost of drugs outside a given health plan. They may also require pharmacies to collect a copay, which in reality is a service charge paid to the benefit manager's company. Plaintiffs insist pharmacy chains have a fiduciary duty to inform consumers of the lowest possible price on prescription drugs. But pharmacy benefits companies have the power to deny consumers access to low-cost generic drugs. Critics of the pharmaceutical industry assert that real reform would consist of a national drug formulary with clear price information available to every American consumer. They say that until Congress acts, consumer advocates must rely on antitrust law and class action lawsuits to win prescription price transparency. The Commonwealth of Puerto Rico escaped the full brunt of Hurricane Irma as it tore through the Caribbean. Still, the island's antiquated electric grid collapsed during the storm, leaving 70% of the island's people without power. It was the culmination of years of neglect and disinvestment owing to Puerto Rico's extended debt crisis. The government-run Electric Power Authority declared bankruptcy in July and defaulted on $9 billion in bonds. Now, electric workers are resisting demands from wealthy bond investors to privatize the power utility. As Puerto Rico has suffered through a long recession over the last decades, over 500,000 residents have moved to the U.S. The island's government is now in an American court working to restructure $120 billion in debt, nearly $35,000 of debt for each of the island's 3.5 million residents. In the face of Hurricane Irma, the Commonwealth did win an emergency declaration from the Trump administration for aid from both the National Guard and FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. All this as the island faces a direct hit from Maria, another Category 5 hurricane. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Not long after Donald Trump won the presidential election with the required Electoral College majority, he falsely claimed that he had lost the popular vote to Hillary Clinton by some 3 million votes because millions of illegal votes were cast for the Democratic candidate. While Trump's accusation is baseless and has been repudiated by both Republican and Democratic state officials, the lie was a central rationale to justify an executive order establishing the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. The commission, chaired by Vice President Mike Pence, and whose vice chair is Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach, has been tasked with studying vulnerabilities in federal elections that can lead to fraudulent voter registrations and fraudulent voting. Critics of the commission point out that Kobach is well known as the architect of voter suppression laws adopted by states across the U.S., as well as Arizona's infamous anti-immigrant papers please law, SB 1070. In late June, Kobach requested voter information from all 50 state governments. However, the request for voters' names, addresses, birth dates, party affiliation, and the last four digits of Social Security numbers was refused outright by 19 states, with others unwilling to comply with key parts of the request. At a commission hearing held in Manchester, New Hampshire on September 12th, Chris Kobach was challenged for a column he had recently written for Breitbart News, asserting that there was proof of enough voter fraud in New Hampshire last November to possibly have influenced the outcome of a Senate race there. Your reporter spoke with investigative journalist Greg Palast, whose film documentary The Best Democracy Money Can Buy examines Kobach's role in employing his cross-check system that wrongly purged some 1.1 million Americans of color from the voter rolls in the 2016 election. Here, Palast examines what he believes to be the true mission of Donald Trump's Election Integrity Commission.
The mainstream press has decided that the Kobach Election Integrity Commission, Trump's special commission, it's all about Trump's ego because he wants to prove that he really won the popular vote. That is complete, can't say it on the air. It's not true. It is not about Trump's ego. It is about swiping the 2018 and 2020 elections. When Trump says 3 million people voted illegally, he's specifically citing, you have to go to the rest of his statement. Trump said people are voting many, many times. This goes back to the charge by his guy Kobach. It's not just a wacky claim. Oh, it's crazy. It's insane. No, no, no. It's worse than that. They actually have a list of 3 million people they claim have voted twice. And I'm the only journalist in the United States who actually bothered to get the list. 3.6 million pairs of names, they say are people are double voters. It's actually 7 million people, Americans, who happened. I'll give you an example. Here's a good one. 583 guys named James Brown supposedly voted twice, once in Georgia and again in another state. Now, you can – and the only evidence that put him on this list is that the first name matches and the last name matches. So James Brown. And that meant that – and this is a real example. James Thomas Brown, supposed to be the same guy as James Everett Brown. And James Brown Sr. is supposed to be the same guy as James Brown Jr. These are actual examples of this list. The middle names don't match. They don't care. Now, why would they do this? This is not about Trump's ego. In the last election, they actually removed 1.1 million people from the voter rolls. Names like Koch and Kobach and, frankly, Hemphill and Palast don't get on this list. It's names like Jose Garcia. It's names like James Brown. It's names like David Lee, Hispanic, Black, Asian American names. In other words, blue voters, Democratic voters, that is minority voters. And that's because 85 of 100 names of the most common names in America are minority names. This is Jim Crow, but instead of white sheets to scare away voters of color, they're using spreadsheets.
And Greg, I wanted to ask, as you examine this so-called Election Integrity Commission, what is your understanding of its objective? Is it simply to provide a rationale for more voter suppression measures in Republican-controlled states, or is there a wider and maybe more dangerous objective that's part of this commission?
Chris Kobach said on Fox TV that he's going to try to take this system of naming double voters, which he calls cross-check, from 28 states, Republican states, to all 50 states by putting it to national law, that you're going to have to purge your voter rolls of double voters. And he's going to give you the list, which is why he asked all 50 states, by the way, to provide him the voter list. And for your information, most of those states that said that they would never turn over to Chris Kobach and this commission their voter rolls did turn over their voter rolls. So what's happening here is that they want to take this system and make it nationwide. They also have a second thing that they want to do. He's made it very clear, Kobach. He's not hiding it. He wants to prove that there are a million illegal aliens who voted in the last election as well. Basically Mexicans who crossed the border to vote for Hillary, you know. So this canard of the alien voters, and what he wants to do, he's taking the Homeland Security lists of deportees. So you're going to, once again, you're going to get names like Jose Hernandez. They're going to say, oh, my gosh, there's a Jose Hernandez who was deported, but there's a Jose Hernandez on the voter rolls of Arizona. And so they have to be removed, the illegal aliens. If they're really removing illegal aliens, why would we wouldn't object? But they're not. What they're doing is they're taking common Latino names. And so you find them on the deportation list, and then they're knocking off American voters with similar names.
That was investigative reporter and author Greg Palast, whose film documentary is titled The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, The Case of the Stolen Election. Find links to Palast's investigation and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. While Donald Trump emerged as a victor in the 2016 presidential election by winning the majority of Electoral College delegates, he lost the popular vote to his Democratic opponent, Hillary Clinton, by nearly 3 million ballots. One of the critical states in determining Trump's narrow victory was Wisconsin, which he won by less than 1% of votes cast. Yet Trump led Clinton in 63 of the state's 99 assembly districts, and 23 of Wisconsin's 33 state Senate districts. The votes of Wisconsin Democrats are less powerful than that of Republicans because of the way in which legislative maps are drawn, where Democratic voters are packed into fewer districts. That produces results where the GOP, whatever its share of the vote in statewide races for president or governor, are likely to win a much higher share of legislative seats. The drawing of legislative district maps to provide an advantage to one party over another is known as partisan gerrymandering. The U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments in an important case known as Gill v. Whitford this October, that challenges partisan gerrymandering. The case reached the Supreme Court after Wisconsin's Republican Governor Scott Walker appealed a November 2016 three-judge federal panel ruling that ordered Wisconsin's legislature to redraw the state assembly map due to what it found to be unconstitutional partisan gerrymandering. Your reporter spoke with Drew Spencer Penrose, legal and policy director with the group Fair Vote. Here, Penrose talks about the importance of this case and possible remedies to prevent partisan manipulation of legislative district maps.
So what partisan gerrymandering is, in this particular case, is when one political party draws district lines in a way to maximize the number of seats they'll get and minimize the number of seats that an opponent party will get. And in Wisconsin, it's Republicans. It actually has been more Republicans than Democrats, mostly because Republicans control more state legislatures than Democrats. But it's not just a Republican problem. In fact, a very similar case is coming out of Maryland, where Democrats pretty openly gerrymandered the state in favor of Democratic candidates. The way that they do it really goes to the heart of the case, and that is that if you can take a district and draw it around a lot of Democratic voters, really pack in the Democratic voters, then the Democratic candidate in that district will win with like 70 or 80% of the vote. And basically that means that a lot of the votes were wasted on a candidate who was going to win anyway. And then the other thing you can do is draw districts so that the Democratic candidates can't possibly win. So if Democrats are 40% of the district, then those votes are all essentially wasted as well because they can't help elect a candidate. And so if you measure these wasted votes and say, are there more wasted votes for Democrats than there are for Republicans, then that means that Republicans' votes are more efficient. They're actually more powerful than Democratic votes. And that's really what partisan gerrymandering is in this case, is where you strategically draw these districts in order to make one group of voters' votes powerful and another group of voters make their votes very not powerful. And this case is arguing that that is unconstitutional. It's not the first case. It's not the first time that people have tried to make this case. However, it's been really very difficult to get courts to buy into any particular theory of how you determine when this has happened and when it hasn't, because it's something that can happen just sort of naturally. The people drawing the district lines will be trying to group communities of interest and that sort of thing. And the system isn't really designed to create a fair representation. It's a winner-take-all system, and so sometimes that creates disparities on its own, and courts have been really hesitant to jump in and try to adjudicate these. But this one's really different. It's a really extreme case of partisan gerrymandering, a really clear case. And what they have that's different from prior cases is that they have developed a test, a very simple mathematical test for how you determine if a state is really very badly lopsided. And that's what Justice Kennedy has asked for before in prior cases where theories like this have failed, is he's asked for a clear test. And this time they have one, so it's a really interesting time. In this case, if the four justices who are now in the court who are considered liberal vote the same way as the four then, which I think most people expect that they will, and Justice Kennedy is convinced, then that will be a 5-justice majority, and that'll be the first case to strike down a partisan gerrymander.
Drew, explain to our audience some of the methods that you and your organization favor for determining district maps across the country, state by state, that won't skew the electorate in a way that, you know, gives one party or the other party a partisan advantage.
So I was talking about wasted votes earlier. Like, that's how gerrymandering is done, is by manipulating wasted votes. The method that we think is really the best for the United States is called ranked choice voting. If you apply ranked choice voting to a 5-winner election, then the number of wasted votes necessarily goes down almost to zero. So, of course, the number of wasted votes will be the same between the Democrats and the Republicans because it'll be zero, right? If there are no wasted votes, then there's no disparity in wasted votes. We've had a proposal that we call the Fair Representation Act. This is a model proposal for electing Congress in multi-winner districts with ranked choice voting. This year in June, Representative Don Beyer from Virginia actually introduced it as a bill. So there's a bill in Congress right now, H.R. 3057, that would elect all of Congress from multi-winner districts with ranked choice voting. That would effectively end gerrymandering for all of Congress.
That was Drew Spencer Penrose, legal and policy director with the group Fair Vote. Find more commentary and analysis on the issue of partisan gerrymandering by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On September 11th, U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut sponsored an emergency field hearing on immigration issues at the same New Haven church where Marco Antonio Reyes had taken sanctuary for more than 6 weeks since he received a deportation order to his native Ecuador. Blumenthal said such hearings can't be held in Washington, D.C., under the Republican congressional leadership, but he hoped to take the stories he heard back to Congress to bolster the effort to pass the DREAM Act that would allow undocumented youth to work or attend school in the U.S. and put them on a path to citizenship. Before the hearing, President Trump had rescinded Barack Obama's executive order known as DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, that would take effect in 6 months, declaring that Congress can use that time to pass legislation allowing these undocumented young people to remain in the U.S. Individuals facing deportation and their family members spoke at the hearing, representing many countries, including South Korea, Canada, Mexico, Brazil, Albania, and Ecuador. Others, including a U.S.-born citizen who was the son of immigrants, spoke and said that an attack on any of them is an attack on him. Three immigration lawyers also addressed the hearing, describing some of the challenges undocumented immigrants face. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was at the hearing and brings us excerpts from two of the speakers. We hear first from Eric Cruz Lopez, a community organizer and programming coordinator with the group Connecticut Students for a Dream. He spoke against the common representation of dreamers as being brought illegally to the U.S. through no fault of their own.
I work day in and day out for undocumented students such as myself because I am undocumented. And I came to this country when I was 7 years old. And when I say I came to this country, I mean that very intentionally because we need to end the narrative that we were brought here to this country through no fault of our own, because we, together with our families, made the difficult, the very, very difficult decision to come to this country together. And I know the majority of us, had we been of age to make a conjunct decision with our parents, we would have all decided to come here together, right? Because I will not stand here and let my families be blamed, and let my parent and my mother be blamed for the decision to come to this country. If they go down, I'll go down with them. I don't believe I will rise above my own conditions if my parents do not come up with me, if the rest of my community doesn't come up with me. I will not work for bills that offer comprehensive immigration reform if they will further criminalize my communities and the communities that live along the border. With that being said, I do have DACA for the moment, and DACA did change a lot of what I could do. I remember when I was in high school, when DACA had just come out, I had been offered an internship for this really good program, right, because I was a really good student. And I had to say no. I had to say no, I can't. I'm undocumented, and I can't take this internship. And that week, we had submitted in our paperwork for DACA, and all we had to do was wait. Eventually, I got my DACA approved, right? It was awesome. It was a great day. But the first thing I did was that I went back to school. I went to the principal's office, and I said, can I take that internship, right? Like, I can work legally now. Can I take that internship? And they said yes. They were like, yes, we'll make that happen as soon as we can, right? Like, we want to make sure that you have that opportunity that you are more than qualified to take. And I took that internship, and that internship opened a lot of doors. That internship allowed me to get a full scholarship to the University of Connecticut, where I'm now studying to be a high school math teacher. A dream that if DACA ends, if I'm not given a pathway to work, will not be accomplished, right? And so I want to ask everybody in this room that you fight not just for me, right? Because I am a high-achieving student. I did graduate a valedictorian. I did go to university on a full scholarship. But I want you to also fight for those who do not fit that mold, because I also am outside the mold, right? There are also a lot of things about me that you do not know right now, that if those were the only things you knew about me, you would decide to not give me a pathway to citizenship. You would decide to not give me a work permit. I want everybody in this room to agree to fight for everybody in my community, for the high achievers, but also for the high school dropouts, for the people who've made a mistake, and also for the people who are parents, workers, nurses, and teachers. So if I can get a verbal commitment, a loud yes, that you will fight for more than just myself, that would make me very happy. So thank you, everybody.
Another speaker was immigration attorney Joanne Lewis.
The DACA, when it was proposed, was done as a stopgap in the hope that the DREAM Act would be passed in the 2 years. But instead, we've had to renew cases and renew cases. I'd like to stray a little bit from DACA and just mention two other things that I see in today's climate about immigration. Many of my clients are domestic violence victims, people that I can do something for the most part. But many of them are afraid now. They're afraid to call the police. They're afraid to go down to the police station to get their fingerprints taken so that I can verify that they have no record when I file their applications. The third thing that I want to mention is I also represent some of the children who've come up recently from Central America, from countries where there are horrible conditions, El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. And those children are in a detention center, nice detention center, it's a shelter in Mystic, Connecticut, but they're having trouble finding sponsors for them, sponsors being family members, generally. And the family members, if they're undocumented, are themselves afraid to take in a child because some of them are being picked up when they come to get the children. That hasn't happened in Connecticut yet, but it's happened in other states. So there are children who are basically in these shelters who may have a way to stay in the United States if they were settled and in a place that somebody could represent them. So these are my frustrations right now. And if we can do nothing else, at least hopefully we can pass the DREAM Act. Thank you.
That was immigration rights attorney Joanne Lewis, preceded by DACA recipient Eric Cruz Lopez, speaking at an immigration hearing held by U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut at a church in New Haven. For more perspectives on DACA and the debate on U.S. immigration policy, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, WGRN in Columbus, Ohio, FRSC in Santa Cruz, California, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
coming up next. Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Major, battling on two fronts. Major Tillery, for many years known as the jailhouse lawyer who led the 1990 Tillery versus Owens prisoners' rights civil case, spawned from unconstitutional conditions at the state prison in Pittsburgh, is still rumbling these days, this time for his life as well as for his freedom. His life, because he recently learned not only that he had hepatitis C, nor that it was chronic, but that his condition was so advanced that he now had cirrhosis of the liver. The news received recently caused shock. The Department of Corrections, which continues to utilize its unconstitutional protocol to delay treatment, has finally begun to treat Tillery, who has to complete a 12-week daily pill regimen composed of a direct-acting antiviral medication like Harvoni or Sovaldi. In his criminal appeals, Major filed a remarkable post-conviction petition arguing that two state witnesses in his case not only testified falsely, but were granted sex visits with their girlfriends by case detectives at the old roundhouse in Center City, Philadelphia, to seal the deal. Or should I say, to sweeten the pot? The DA's office response? That Tillery didn't file a timely petition. For real. Major has, of course, appealed. He continues to rumble today on two fronts from imprisoned nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. DACA, the latest from the un-Obama. If there is one unifying principle emerging from the disaster known as the Trump regime, it's the president's singular obsession and mission to erase the executive presence of his predecessor, Barack Obama. This may be seen most recently in Trump's bumbling undoing of Obama's executive order known as DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, done to further endear him to his so-called base, white nationals who love to hear about the suffering of non-white others. Under DACA, some 800,000 young people, many brought to America as babies, were given a pass to live, study, and work in America, often the only home they've ever known. Trump's revocation of DACA snatches that pass away, sending tremors of fear of deportation in nearly a million people. Incredibly, just days before he formally issued his executive revocation, he talked about how much he loved DACA kids. Strange kind of love there. Meanwhile, Latinos, who are among the largest number of DACA recipients, who come here because of U.S.-supported state violence in Honduras, Guatemala, and Central America, after the slap in the face of the pardon of Joe Arpaio, the racist and former Arizona sheriff, found in criminal contempt of a federal court order, are in no mood for Trumpian love. They know that he ran on anti-Mexican, anti-Latino fear and hatred. What's love got to do with it? From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Merci d'être ici, en ce temps de folie. Mes amis, messieurs, mes frères et mes camarades de France, merci pour votre courage et votre présence aujourd'hui. En l'Amérique, aujourd'hui, prégnante la folie, le racisme, and des haines grandissant une courage pour un État capitaliste. L'Amérique est un proie au chaos impulsé pour une incompétence profonde et une ferme détermination à diviser la classe ouvrière. C'est le règne de la haine, de la mesquinerie et de l'ignorance. C'est un État en déclin. La maladie au cœur de l'Amérique, tant à l'intérieur qu'à l'extérieur, dépèse. Ne se vivre pas à l'épreuve de vérité. Aujourd'hui, plus que jamais, nous avons besoin d'unité. Les gens doivent s'unir contre la haine, la cupidité et la mort. Merci beaucoup. À vous tous. La meilleure de la France. À part l'Empire. Vive l'unité, la mort et la liberté. Bon amour, mes amis. C'est Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Who is Aung San Suu Kyi, and how appropriate are her international credentials as a pro-democracy hero? Was her pro-democracy activism truly grassroots, or did she have help from Western centers? Why has the Rohingyan crisis suddenly erupted in mainstream media and political consciousness? What geostrategic significance does Myanmar play in the region, and how is that affecting world response to the Rohingya crisis? Who is the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army, and what connection do they have with the Saudi kingdom? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we take a closer look at the Rohingyan crisis in Myanmar and how it may be used to advance certain imperial aims. Our guests include journalist and broadcaster Stephen Lendman, as well as writer and Mint Press News contributor Whitney Webb. On this week's program, Downfall of an Icon, Aung San Suu Kyi, the Rohingyans, and the Bigger Picture. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of September 22nd, 2017. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Israeli historian Avner Cohen, as well as the award-winning U.S. journalist Seymour Hersh, have confirmed the existence of the so-called Samson option, wherein Israel will deploy its nuclear weapons if it feels its security is threatened. During his speech at the UN, Netanyahu alluded to the Samson option in saying, quote, "Those who threaten us with annihilation put themselves in mortal peril. Israel will defend itself with the full force of our arms and the full power of our convictions." In this sense, Iran has much more to fear from Israel than Israel has to fear from Iran. Yet, ironically, it is Israel that continually protests about its own fears. That comes from the article, Fact-Checking Benjamin Netanyahu's General Assembly Speech by Adam Gary, posted September 20th, originally appearing at The Duran. The Kurds are allied with Syria's fiercest enemy, Israel, whose planned Greater Israel project coincidentally aligns almost perfectly with the Kurds' plans for Kurdistan. in the Oded Yunan plan, which is the plan for a greater Israel, it states the imperative use of Kurds to help divide neighboring countries in order to aid in their plans for greater domination. Interestingly enough, Kurds brush this alliance off as being just another step in achieving their ultimate goal of creating an autonomous Kurdistan. Every major Kurdish political group in the region has long-standing ties to Israel. It's all linked to major ethnic violence against Arabs, Turkmens, and Assyrians. That comes from the article, "Amidst universal opposition to KRG referendum, Israel stands by Kurds," by Sarah Abed, posted September 20th. The United States of America is the world's greatest superstate with the largest economy and global GDP. It possesses the most powerful military machine in history, backed by the largest arsenal of nuclear weapons in existence. Its sidekick in the Middle East is the State of Israel, and they work in concert to exert disproportionate influence on both the global economy and international politics through their combined position in the United Nations and through the economic and political power of the Likud-leaning U.S. Congress. All this is done publicly with no attempt to hide this blatant bilateral U.S.-Israeli agenda. That agenda is to overtly increase the economic and political power of Washington to the exclusion and at the expense of the other 191 member states of the United Nations General Assembly that includes Britain, Germany, France, Spain, and Italy, among others in Europe. That comes from the article, "The UN, Trump, and Netanyahu. When did democracy, justice, and equality just disappear?" by Anthony Bell Chambers, posted September 20th. According to the Israeli spokesperson, the establishment of a U.S. base in Israel will send a, quote, message to the region, unquote. Whether that's perceived as a positive message or a message of U.S. imperial expansion remains to be seen, but by most accounts, it's likely to be the latter. If anything, the establishment of a U.S. base in occupied Palestine could help to reinvigorate the international pro-Palestinian activist movement, which traditionally has had an anti-imperialist message in its mission. Generally speaking, it's hard to see how such a move by the U.S. can be seen as a positive development for the region. Add to this other direct provocations by the U.S. on behalf of Israel, and we have a recipe for potential disaster down the road. That comes from the article, "A New Provocation, U.S. Establishes First Permanent Military Base Inside of Israel," by Patrick Henningsen, posted September 20th, originally appearing at 21st Century Wire. There are bills designed to further punish and discredit the already weakened PA, deny funding to UNWRA, outlaw the BDS movement, and recognize through clever sleight-of-hand language Israel's control over the territories. The Trump administration, which began its tenure proposing to deliver, quote, a great deal, unquote, to end the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, has reportedly lowered its ambitions to a proposal mirroring a long-discredited 40-year-old Likud concept of, quote, unquote, limited Palestinian autonomy, denying Palestinians full sovereignty and any rights in Jerusalem while releasing large areas of the West Bank to Israeli expansion. Netanyahu, the Likud, and their neoconservative allies can rightly claim that the vision they projected for the Middle East in a clean break is being realized. But in reality, what they have created is an unsustainable mess that includes a weakened and dependent PA that was denied the ability to govern, causing it to lose legitimacy, a fractured Palestinian polity with Hamas in control of a humanitarian disaster in Gaza, an Iraq in shambles and, in its wake, an empowered and emboldened Iran, and a metastasized terrorist threat that now challenges many countries, and a hardened, though divided, Israeli electorate from which it is unlikely to see any new peace-oriented leadership emerging. So this is the house that Bibi built. That comes from the article, "The House That Bibi Built as Prime Minister of Israel," by James Zogby, posted September 19th, originally appearing at Loblog. Trump's address may be similar in some respects to George Bush's 2002 State of the Union speech designating North Korea, Iran, and Iraq an axis of evil. In March 2003, war on Iraq was waged on the pretext of non-existent WMDs. War plans against Iran were prepared, similar ones ready to attack North Korea, neither implemented so far. Trump is hostage to hawkish generals running his administration's geopolitical agenda. Instead of being a peace and stability leader, he's the latest in a long line of U.S. warrior presidents, at war in multiple theaters, threatening more conflicts, risking possible nuclear confrontation with North Korea, Russia, and or China. That comes from the article, Trump's UN address to call for action against non-existent North Korean and Iranian threats by Stephen Lendman, posted September 19th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. She's been called the Asian Mandela. Aung San Suu Kyi, the daughter of General Aung San, a Myanmar independence hero, spent much of her youth abroad. She returned to Myanmar in 1988, at a time when students, office workers, and monks were rising up by the thousands against then-dictator General Ne Win. Claiming to draw inspiration from the non-violent struggles of Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King, Aung San Suu Kyi organized and led rallies across the country calling for democratic reform and free elections. The rallies were suppressed by the military and Suu Kyi placed under house arrest. The leader of the National League for Democracy was recognized for her pro-democracy efforts, which earned her a Nobel Peace Prize in 1991. Her iconic status only continued to increase as she would spend much of her time from 1989 to 2010 under house arrest, even denied access to her sons and husband during the early years of her detention. Victories in the 2012 parliamentary by-election secured major gains for her party, the NLD. She took on the role of opposition leader. Then in 2015, her party won an overwhelming majority in parliament. Suu Kyi is barred constitutionally from assuming the office of president, given her son's status as UK passport holders. Over the last year, and particularly recent weeks, Suu Kyi's sterling international reputation is becoming tarnished as word of ethnic cleansing and brutalization of the minority Rohingya population is getting out. There's open talk of having her Nobel Prize rescinded. In Canada, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is facing pressure to have Suu Kyi's status as an honorary Canadian citizen revoked. Mainstream media and politicians may be a little late in the game when it comes to critical reportage on Aung San Suu Kyi's background. Here with me to discuss the international community's fascination with the Myanmar icon is Stephen Lendman. He is an independent journalist, blogger, and broadcaster with the Progressive Radio Network. He's a Project Censored winner and recipient of the Mexican Journalists Club International Journalism Award. He's also the editor of and contributor to the 2014 book Flashpoint in Ukraine, How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. From Clarity Press. He's also a frequent contributor to Global Research and a frequent guest on this program. Stephen Lendman, welcome back to the Global Research NewsHour.
Michael, it's wonderful being on with you. The Rohingya is certainly a big issue. It's an issue that I had only addressed once a couple of years ago, and then more recently I wrote a couple of articles on it. I'm not an expert on the area or the conflict or anything that's going on. But I had my say in two articles, and it really is a hideous situation. These poor people for decades, literally for decades, have been viciously persecuted by the Myanmar government. Over a million people. I think it was a good many more, maybe hundreds of thousands more than this. I think currently about a million 100,000 or so population in Myanmar. Hundreds of thousands fled across the border to Bangladesh. They're certainly not given a warm welcome there. The kind of refugee camps that get set up, whether it's in Bangladesh or most other countries, are pretty deplorable places. In France, they were deplorable places. You can imagine what they're like in Bangladesh. But the Rohingyas are being slaughtered, and Aung San Suu Kyi, a Nobel Peace Prize winner in 1991, a generation ago, simply is totally unsympathetic to their plight.
Now, I did notice that you wrote an essay back in November of 2015, just before the elections, which saw Aung San Suu Kyi's party, the National League for Democracy, rise to power. You were critical of Aung San Suu Kyi way back before anyone was talking about the Rohingyas, seems to me. Is the Rohingyan crisis your principal source of skepticism about this widely praised figure?
I have not looked into exactly what she's doing in the government. I think the only way you can get along with the regime in Myanmar, Michael, really a junta regime, is you either go along with them or you run into a great deal of trouble. Well, Suu Kyi was under house arrest for a good number of years. She herself went through a lot of persecution, and suddenly she's a leading figure in the government. I don't think she really has much power. The generals pretty much decide what they're going to do, regardless of what she will do or say or whatever. But if she doesn't go along with them, then she'll probably end up in big trouble with them. So she does that. I don't know how much of a shield her Nobel Peace Prize is. It certainly helps more than not having it. But she desecrated the award, just the way most of the others do. The awards are usually made to war criminals. And since Suu Kyi is complicit with the war crimes and crimes against humanity, against the Rohingya people, she's a war criminal.
Okay. I know that there was a fascinating report, and you actually cited it in your 2015 article. It's from 2006, Burma Campaign UK, which is a London-based group campaigning for human rights, democracy, and development in Burma, as they put it, which is what Myanmar was called before 1948. And the report seems favorable to the kinds of reforms Suu Kyi was calling for and involved in. But it also takes pains to mention funding for groups aligned with her. These include George Soros's Open Policy Institute and the National Endowment for Democracy, groups heavily aligned with Western, particularly U.S. imperial aims. I'm wondering, knowing this, if the involvement in these quote-unquote democracy-promoting activities from abroad affect your estimation of the movement aligned with and behind Aung San Suu Kyi.
Well, of course, Michael, the so-called democracy-promoting agendas are very undemocratic. Anything the NED or Soros or like-minded people and groups are involved in want to subvert democracy, not promote it. And apparently Suu Kyi is very accommodative on preventing real democracy in Myanmar, which would be impossible given the junta running things. It's a repressive regime. America courts the country, China courts the country, other nations court the country, and Suu Kyi is used as a national icon, but her iconic status really is phony given the way she operates. And a speech she gave just a few days ago, she made the astonishing claim that the government is really using legal tactics to deal with the Rohingyas. She also, earlier in a statement she made to a UN humanitarian individual, that he should avoid using the term Rohingya, calling it an emotionally emotive term. So that really isn't a good term to use. I don't know what you call them if you don't call them what they are. What would you call Palestinians if you don't call them Palestinians? So, I mean, her comments are really absurd, claiming the regime is acting legally and not wanting even to mention the word Rohingya. She really betrays the principles that she espoused when she gave her Nobel laureate address over a generation ago, Michael.
And at the same time, we've got mainstream politicians and media speaking out a lot more. In my country, the prime minister is being pressured to take away her status as an honorary Canadian citizen, and there's been talk about taking away his Nobel Peace Prize. Do you think these are examples of progress on the part of mainstream politicians and mainstream media from abroad, that they are changing their tune with regard to the or seemingly coming to the defense of the Rohingyas?
Well, I think the outrage about what's going on with the Rohingyas is so extreme that it gets a little bit of press and it just picks up steam, I think, Michael. So it's hard to ignore the fact that these people are being slaughtered. About the only time Palestinians get a lot of press is when Israel goes to war with Gaza, which happened 3 times since December 2008. Then it gets a lot of press, and you even get Palestinians being interviewed on mainstream media, quoted in the New York Times and the Washington Post. And at the same time, I'm surprised that there have been some major media commentaries, the Washington Post, I think the New York Times, I'm sure others, are very sympathetic to the Rohingyas and very upset at Suu Kyi for what she's doing and what she's not doing. This thing could blow over. The Rohingyas have been persecuted for many decades, and it goes in fits and spurts. It can go on for a while, weeks or months, then it can subside, and then it can pick up again. So maybe in the weeks ahead, if this the current abuses subside, maybe that will go out of the headlines, and there won't be any more stories about them, and no more criticism of Suu Kyi. And it's easy how the media can simply forget things or simply thrust them down the memory hole. This happened so many times, Michael. The fact, a good example that sticks in my mind always is that Iraq, Saddam Hussein, destroyed his WMDs, and his son-in-law, Hussein Kamel, interviewed, among other places, on CNN, saying that, he was the guy in charge of getting rid of the weapons program. And he said, on CNN, he said they were all destroyed. Well, of course, that was forgotten ahead of the run-up to the war in 2003. So the same thing could happen to the Rohingyas, Michael. There could be a lot of sympathy for them now. There can be a lot of criticism about Suu Kyi's policies and comments and everything else. And then some weeks or months from now, it can all be forgotten, and everything will be swept under the rug again.
I'm kind of fascinated by the fact that this figure has been such a huge icon, the Nobel Peace Prize and the very, very favorable attention she got, being compared to figures like Nelson Mandela, for example. And I'm just thinking about this idea of the celebrity as a tool of empire. Another example that comes to mind, and please correct me if you think this is off base, but I remember back at the time of the 2004 Orange Revolution, where Viktor Yushchenko, who was an opposition leader, and he was he'd gotten this skin condition, and he too had become gotten iconic status, at least for a time. And so then shortly after that, there were new elections, and he rose to power. Can I get you some of the thoughts about the celebrity, at least in Western media circles, and that role that it plays in enabling U.S. imperial interest?
Oh, indeed. Although Yushchenko was not an iconic figure by any means, and I believe it was Yanukovych.
Well, he was at the time, was he not? Just around the time of the 2004 election, it just seems to me he was getting I'm not saying that he was somebody, but that he was in the Western press. There were very sympathetic portrayals of the man around that time.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about that, Michael. America's Orange Revolution. So the press will support the candidate that America supports, so they build him up. This guy Saakashvili in Georgia, an absolute scoundrel. A Stalinesque figure, a Hitlerian figure, and supported by Western media. And that was back then, the Rose Revolution in Georgia. So Yushchenko, the same thing. And I think it was Yanukovych who was deposed in 2004. war. Then deposed again. He came back from the dead, so to speak, and deposed again in 2014, and now living in Russia with a warrant for his arrest in Ukraine, which will never be exercised. Mm-hmm. But you're right, Michael. Your comments are very well taken.
Yeah. And I, of course, you know, since you did come out with the book Flashpoint in Ukraine, I figure that, you know, some of these sorts of sentiments are still in the minds, that the important role of public relations and Aung San Suu Kyi in particular, having such a positive portrayal in the international press, or at least in the Western press. And so I'm just wondering what you have any thoughts of if she is somehow is she a media fabrication, or how do you position her in relation to other celebrities, if I can call them that, or icons that have been presented to us in the Western press?
I put it this way, Michael. Whatever she may have been before, whatever kind of person, whatever she might have believed in, if you go back to the early 1990s or earlier, her father, a very important figure in Burma, I guess, it was Myanmar in those days. You mentioned since 1948, I didn't know the date. But whatever she was then, she's an entirely different person now in what she is and what she stands for. So she wasn't the real thing all along. You either are what you are and you stay what you are, but if you change along the way for the worst, then you never were good in the first place, in my mind. I think it's one thing to be less than noble and somehow get religion and become a much more noble figure later on. I think that to me is an acceptable way to be. But to put on noble credentials and then later on completely betray them. And we're not talking about minor stuff. We're talking about what I call slow motion genocide in Myanmar, which really is that. I mean, these people are just being slaughtered and brutalized. Their women are being raped. There's just horrible stuff going on. That is just unacceptable for anybody who claims to be a Democrat and claims to be on the right side of issues to suddenly either ignore what's going on or being on the wrong side of it. She certainly is not supporting the Rohingyas. And to me, being part of the government in Myanmar, she's supporting it, which makes her a criminal. So she never was the real thing all along. That's my belief.
Mm. Well, what do you make of the fact that the international community is noticing the Rohingyas, but maybe not the Yemen, you know, the people of Yemen, or you know, other you know, peoples who equivalently deserve some consideration on the part of those of us who care about human rights and democracy and such?
Oh, indeed, Michael, and it's one ethnic group after another.
But the point is that the Rohingyan crisis is getting more recognition apparently than other equivalent or even worse scenarios. So what do you make of that?
Well, of course, you'd have to add at the moment, because you could go back 6 months and nobody talked about the Rohingyas, and maybe 6 months from now nobody will talk about them again. Maybe it'll come up again some other time in the future. But I think it's a short-lived recognition of the plight of these people. The only people that seem to stay in the spotlight a little bit are the Palestinians. I say a little bit because the only time they really get attention is when Israel goes to war with Gaza or there's something major happening in the West Bank or East Jerusalem. Otherwise, the Palestinians get very little play. But they still get some play, especially with the BDS movement and so on. But whether it's the Kurds, the only reason the Kurds are getting play now, or earlier when they wanted to demonize Saddam Hussein for the crimes he committed against them, so they built up the plight of the Kurds then way back. And now the Kurds are being used by Washington as a proxy force against the Syrian. They're not fighting the Syrian government yet. Been a couple of clashes, which could get much more serious. But they're operating illegally along with terrorists in the so-called SDF, Free Syrian Army. so many different names, the Free Syrian Army, which to me is just a terrorist organization. Any group in Syria, in another country, supported by America against the government is a terrorist organization. So the Kurds are getting played because it's going along with America, but the Kurds could go back into oblivion again if suddenly they're not needed by Washington anymore. And the Yemenis, of course, are a very important issue, maybe the most persecuted country in the world. With bombs falling every day, the persecution of the Rohingyas is absolutely despicable. The Myanmar government isn't bombing them, slow-motion killing them. I guess the people in Yemen are being slow-motion killed as well, but you get terror bombing going on all the time. And now Trump has picked up the terror bombing, either U.S. warplanes or drones or both, conducting raids in Yemen. So these people are just devastated, and they're enduring starvation, diseases that aren't being treated, a terrible cholera epidemic that's expanding. I think the last number I saw was about 600,000 people affected. I mean, this is just utter devastation. And what kind of play are they getting? Very little. I can't say nothing because there's been some, but very, very little.
Okay. Well, we're just about the end of our time, but I just wanted to give you a chance to promote. You've got a website. Like you, it's not just the blog site. You've got a StephenLenman.org?
Yes, it's a new website. It's been up since June, so about 3 months it's been operating. StephenLenman.org, and I keep all my articles there. I set up a blog many years ago only as a place to store all my articles in one place, and it turned out that other people found it, and now I have a website, and people use it. I'm delighted about that. I post my articles on it all the time, and I'm delighted with important websites like Global Research supporting what I do.
Stephen Lenman, thanks for joining us.
Michael, thank you so much.
We've been speaking with independent journalist, blogger, and broadcaster Stephen Lenman. As you just heard, his website, where most of his articles are stored, is at stephenlenman.org. And you can also hear his show, The Progressive Radio Hour, which is airs on the Progressive Radio Network.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
The Rohingya crisis has gotten prominent attention in recent weeks. On Wednesday, September 13th, it got top billing during a press conference at which UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres spoke to reporters on the occasion of the 72nd session of the General Assembly. Here were his remarks on the crisis.
We have a very busy week ahead. Global leaders will gather here next week at a time when our world faces major threats. First, the situation in Myanmar. Grievances that have been left to fester for decades have now escalated beyond Myanmar's borders, destabilizing the region. The humanitarian situation is catastrophic. When we met last week, there were 125,000 Rohingya refugees who had fled into Bangladesh. That number has now tripled to nearly 380,000. Many are staying in makeshift settlements or with host communities who are generally sharing what they have. But women and children are arriving hungry and malnourished. I urge all countries to do what they can for humanitarian assistance to be provided. As you know, I wrote an official letter to the Security Council to express my concern, and I welcome the Council's decision to discuss this crisis today. I have condemned the attacks made by the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army. But in Rakhine State, there have been disturbing reports of attacks by security forces against civilians, which are completely unacceptable. Aid activities by UN agencies and international non-governmental organizations have been severely disrupted. I call on the Myanmar authorities to suspend military action, end the violence, uphold the rule of law, and recognize the right of return of all those who had to leave the country.
The Rohingya are a minority Muslim group numbering around 1 million inhabiting Myanmar's Rakhine State. According to UN statistics, more than 370,000 Rohingya have fled to Bangladesh to escape violence since August 25th, according to the United Nations, at almost an average of almost 20,000 a day. On Wednesday, September 13th, the UN Security Council issued a statement acknowledging attacks on Myanmar security forces but condemning the subsequent violence directed at Rohingya population and called for, quote, immediate steps to end the violence in Rakhine, de-escalate the situation, and reestablish law and order, ensure the protection of civilians, unquote. Ethnic cleansing is the charge being directed at the Myanmar government and formerly venerated head of state Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi. But of course, as is frequently the case when it comes to human rights abuses highlighted in the mainstream press, there is more going on behind the scenes. Making her debut on the Global Research NewsHour radio show is Whitney Webb. She is a contributor to Mint Press News and has written for several news organizations in both English and Spanish. Her stories have been featured on Zero Hedge, The Anti-Media, 21st Century Wire, and True Activist, among others. She recently authored an article for Mint Press, which places the Rohingya crisis in a geopolitical context. She joins us now from southern Chile in Temuco. So, Whitney Webb, welcome to the Global Research NewsHour.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Now, the name of your article is Oil, Gas, Geopolitics Guide U.S. Hand in Playing the Rohingya Crisis. You note that China borders Myanmar to the northeast. Could you explain the economic and strategic significance of these pipelines, which you mentioned, from the standpoint of Western and particularly U.S. aims in the region?
Right. So the Shuai gas pipelines, well, that's what the name of the oil field is called, named after the Burmese former leader of the junta that was there for a long time. So these are, there's two pipelines. There's one that's natural gas and there's one that's oil. The natural gas pipeline has been operational since 2014. Construction began on both in around 2011, not that long after, a few years after the oil and the gas, the gas was discovered near there. The oil pipeline still is not operational. It's expected to become operational later this year. And honestly, though the gas pipeline is, of course, of major benefit to China, the oil pipeline is definitely much more geopolitically strategic, mainly because 80% of China's oil currently, meaning like its imported oil from the Middle East and Africa, travels very far through the Strait of Malacca, which is between Malaysia, Singapore, and Indonesia, and then crosses through the South China Sea and then arrives to China. And of course, as many people know, there are lots of disputed areas in the South China Sea. The U.S. has definitely made that a sort of a hot spot, if you will, between Chinese and U.S. relations and Chinese and U.S. interests in the region. So China, with the completion of this oil pipeline in Myanmar, will be able to avoid any potential conflicts that could arise were the U.S. and China, for example, to enter into a major geopolitical conflict of some type. You know, the U.S., because of its naval bases there, would be able to impose a blockade on the Straits of Malacca. And this would, of course, prevent 80% of Chinese oil from arriving. So now you would just have that oil traveling to the coast of Myanmar and then to the being pumped into the pipeline and then traveling to China that way, giving China the ability to circumvent that major strategical advantage that the U.S. currently holds. And, of course, the article that you referenced that I wrote recently is that this is a major piece of the puzzle of why there is sudden interest in the Rohingya crisis, which has honestly been ongoing for over a century. And in terms of its most recent escalation has started around like late last year and also in 2011 as well. And those were largely absent from the news. Mm-hmm. But this time is apparently different, and a lot of it most likely has to do with the fact that the Chinese oil pipeline is about to go live in the next few months.
Yeah. You mentioned that the oil pipelines have yet to be completed. Is there any specific reason why has the construction been impeded in some way, or are they going according to plan and it's simply not getting completed
Well, it's been complicated for several reasons. One of them is that Myanmar has several ethnic conflicts, not just the Rohingya issue. In the states bordering China as well, there are significant civil wars, if you will, that are still ongoing in the region. So you have had that sort of conflict as one part of it. You also have strong local opposition in some areas to the pipeline, and you have significant opposition, for example, in the Rakhine state, which is where the Rohingya live. You've had them complain in large amounts of protests of this minority in particular, claiming that the project has polluted rivers, it's destroyed private property, and it's made it impossible for the local fishermen to earn a living by polluting the water, or waters being the coastal areas being crowded by boats, like oil tankers or gas tankers and whatnot, and that it's made it impossible for them, the people that were there before the pipeline, to work. So there's been lots of anti-pipeline demonstrations and unrest. And of course, China is well aware that this can have an impact on their infrastructure projects in Myanmar, because they had a dam project in 2011, and that was closer to the border of China. And that was shut down because of the strong public opposition. So you've definitely had public opposition and protests and things like that, complicating issues, causing complications for the construction of these two pipelines.
Okay. Now, what distinguishes the Rohingya is that they are considered like, unlike the other local ethnic and other, you know, farmers,
right,
and other interests, the Rohingya aren't considered nationalist Myanmar nationals. And,
right, they have no citizenship. Right.
Okay, and so that's figuring into this whole struggle, and they may be giving the Myanmar government perhaps a freer hand. But I mean,
yeah, I would say so, because I mean, they don't really have, they're not the Myanmar government doesn't have to really respect their rights the same way, because they're not considered citizens. So they aren't afforded the same protections that any other Myanmar official citizen is given.
Mm-hmm.
And, so that's definitely true.
Yeah. And of course, the Myanmar government does have an incentive in having this pipeline completed.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because the plan is that they're going to receive, when both are completed, over $7 million per year just in right-of-way fees. And that's not even counting that the Ministry of Energy, they're like the state energy company, has large stakes in these pipelines as well. Not majority stakes, but significant stakes.
Okay.
And they also own several blocks of the gas field, which is in, by the way, the gas field is in the ocean. It's in the bay, so it's like set off in blocks, and several of those blocks are owned by Myanmar State Energy Company.
Okay, now the Myanmar government is claiming to respond to attacks from militants. And
right.
Could you maybe explain what you understand about this group, the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army?
Right. So they're ARSA for short, and it's much easier to say the acronym than the entire name. So anyway, they've been called the insurgency by the government. And, you know, they've sort of been portrayed in the international media, CNN, Al Jazeera, you know, those type of outlets have sort of portrayed them as freedom fighters and whatnot, and that they're a local response to the longstanding state suppression against this minority group. But actually, there's a lot more going on here if you look at who ARSA really is. I mean, they're led by a Pakistani national whose last name is Junjuni. And he, prior to coming to Myanmar, worked as an imam in Saudi Arabia of the Wahhabi sect, which if anyone follows sort of like terrorist insurgencies around the world, they're almost all Wahhabists, which is a minority sect, if you will, in Islam, that is the state religion of Saudi Arabia, essentially, and it's generally considered very extremist. So you have, you know, this man, Junjuni, who's leading the group, in nominally leading the group anyway, but the group is has openly been admitted by the international media, Reuters, the Associated Press and whatnot, as being financed by both Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, though not specifically who is financing it, but the money is coming from there, and that you have a committee of 20 immigrants of the Rohingya group that are headquartered in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, and they claim to be overseeing all of the actions of the group at any given time. So this is kind of a frank admission that this is a sort of a Saudi-funded operation, sort of in the same spirit as numerous other insurgencies, if you will, or terrorist groups that are active in various other countries that are being destabilized at any given time. Syria, the Philippines, you know, they get around. So anyway, so ARSA has been directly responsible for the crackdown on these on the civilians. Right, because every time the military has gone around and burned villages or killed innocent people, it's allegedly at least been directly in response to ARSA attacks on military bases. And if you look at a map, there's one that I included in my article of the pipelines and the military bases. There's tons of military installations that follow the pipeline through its entire stretch through the country. So, you know, there's a lot of military buildup in these areas, and you're having ARSA lead, you know, strategically planned, obviously, attacks that aren't really meant to do anything. They're not really meant to, you know, remove these the military installations in Rakhine State, but they're definitely creating the pretext for retaliation. And it's also interesting to notice that Saudi Arabia is also spending billions of dollars constructing Wahhabi mosques right in the areas where the Rohingya are fleeing in Bangladesh, assumably to keep ARSA a very notable but influenceable force in the region for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, and I'm just – when you talk about these Wahhabi groups, I mean – I'm very much reminded – I mean, you mentioned Syria, for example, and
– Right.
But I'm kind of reminded of the Yugoslavia situation, because if memory serves, there was a lot of criticism of the Serbian government for ethnic cleansing without acknowledging the attacks that prompted those retaliations. And so I'm seeing a sort
right.
of the same pattern at work here in particular.
Well, it's a pattern that gets, you know, repeated frequently. I mean, ethnic cleansing in terms of what the UN will call ethnic cleansing or the U.S. Or even the corporate media will call ethnic cleansing is very selective. You know, at the same time, you have this Rohingya crisis going on, which has been dominating headlines for the past month or so. You know, you have this massive crisis in Yemen that's like supposed to be the worst humanitarian crisis in recent history, and you see very minimal coverage on that, and that has been called genocide on the part of the Saudis against the Yemeni people. And then you have, you know, ethnic cleansing examples, honestly, the world over. You know, in South America, for example, you have Colombia. They deprived their largest indigenous group of its entire water source, and you've had 14,000 children die there in 5 years, and there's been no media coverage of that at all. Right. So in terms of the selectivity here, you know, it's only when calling something ethnic cleansing, whether it is or not, serves a purpose. And that's what we have here. You know, it's because of the longstanding persecution of the Rohingya. It's very likely that this is in the same lines as those other things, but it's being treated differently because there are different interests that are that stand to benefit from the characterization of the situation as such.
So I'm looking at this, the leader, Nobel Peace Prize winner, Aung San Suu Kyi, who just a few years ago was being you know, venerated and
right.
And
she has been for years.
Yes,
in that way. Yeah,
but you know, she is very much a tool of U.S. Western interests. Yet she's supporting this pipeline. So are her loyalties divided in some sense, or what do you make of this attack? You know, via these Wahhabi groups against her authority.
Right. Well, I think it's, you know, it's complicated for her because she, you know, especially the time when she was receiving so much funding from the U.S., she didn't technically have political power. Her political power was vested in the fact that she was not nominally the leader of the country, that she was an opposition leader. You know, she was has been for years received her political party, the National League for Democracy, they have received millions and millions and millions from the U.S. government, USAID, the National Endowment for Democracy, and what have you. So, I mean, it was largely expected that once she became president, that she would begin serving U.S. interests. You know, and she's done that to some extent. I mean, once she became president, I mean, the government contracts and whatnot that were being offered, a lot more of them went to U.S. corporations. Of course, this, you could argue that that was because the Obama administration waited to lift sanctions on Myanmar until after she became president, even though that was around that was last year, and Myanmar has ostensibly been a democracy since 2011. But, you know, you have a sort of a case here where Suu Kyi has decided to pursue, it seems like anyway, Myanmar's state interests instead of the U.S.'s state interests in the area, because she has, during her presidency, definitely forged close ties with China. She's been to Beijing twice, but in contrast, she's rejected invitations from U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, and hasn't really, like, been very actively engaged with the Trump administration anyway, so she's definitely been focused on Chinese stuff. In recent visits, she's like praised China for their support for her government and the peace process, because obviously China has a vested interest in things being quite calm in Myanmar, so that their economic projects or their infrastructure projects can continue without issue. And the U.S. probably didn't necessarily plan on this. They had probably expected, because of all the money they had given her, and basically, you know, the reason she exists as a political figure has a lot to do with their support over the years. But she has ended up serving the interests of her own country at this time. I argue in my piece that the U.S. is trying to play both sides of the situation here. That on one hand, you know, they know that the Saudis are funding this insurgency that is causing this crisis. You know, they are allowing, you know, the corporate media and whatnot to report excessively on this issue, bring it under a microscope. You know, there's this this effort to discredit Suu Kyi in the news right now. Whether or not it's warranted, I'm not really saying. I, you know, plenty of reasons to criticize any world leader. But on the other hand, you have the U.S. coming in on the backside to Myanmar's government saying, hey, we're not really going to get involved because we want to support you, but let's work more closely militarily. And this is the back door through which the U.S. is seeking to have its influence, because if you're following what the Trump administration has been doing lately, it's very military dominated. I mean, the Trump administration right now is basically run by a trio of generals, a junta, if you will.
Yeah.
Because it's essentially become that in some ways. So a lot of the foreign policy is through the military. And you see that same sort of thing going on here.
So how do you see this situation playing out then, if Aung San Suu Kyi decides to continue to govern in the national interest as opposed to these Western interests? I mean, would we be looking at a regime change a la Syria sort of operation, a balkanization?
Well, I don't think it'll be like Syria, because in Assad's case, you know, he's very independent of Western things, and his greatest allies are the greatest rival nations of the U.S., Iran, and Russia. In this case, I think if the crisis gets so bad to a certain point, I don't think Suu Kyi would have the same problem that someone like Assad would, for example, and asking for U.S. military assistance over Chinese military assistance, for example, which is what the U.S. is certainly hoping will happen and is what they're basically trying to do right now. The National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA of the U.S., if passed in its current form, would, for example, normalize fully the ties between the militaries of Myanmar and the U.S., despite the fact that the Myanmar military, you know, doesn't really have a good reputation right now, Rohingya crisis aside, you know, just because of the junta and its history, the military government that was in Myanmar for so long. But anyway, that would enable the U.S. to provide, just open the floodgates for weapons, technical assistance, logistical assistance, and even military bases in the area, which is what the U.S. ultimately wants, because you have the U.S.-China containment policy playing out on a massive scale right now, where pretty much almost every Chinese border state, except for Russia, obviously, there are either major tensions there or regime change threats. If the government is not already friendly to U.S. interests, and if it is friendly to U.S. interests, they have been buying up U.S. arms at, I don't know if I'd say historic rates, but it's definitely huge jumps. Big examples there are Taiwan, Japan, and South Korea. But you also have the same thing going on with Vietnam, and you have a whole bunch of it's just a mess, honestly. But so, you know, Myanmar is no different because China sees Myanmar as, you know, as a strategic border country because it's, you know, has so many economic ties with China, which it has had historically as well, and serves a strategic purpose. And they've also even China's also talked about establishing its own naval base in Myanmar, which the U.S. Does not want, obviously, at all.
Yes, that that ongoing Asia pivot.
Right.
And
that's such a euphemism for what's actually going on.
Yeah.
Pivot sounds so subtle.
And it's interesting. I just maybe just before we wrap up, I'm kind of curious to know about what China's options are, because they are also facing something similar happening in the Philippines. Interestingly enough, you know, the other area in the region where you're seeing this Wahhabist insurgency, and it just, you know, happens to be, you know, fitting into U.S. Imperial aims. So what is China's options in terms of countering this? Can they do anything?
In terms of the containment policy?
Yeah.
As a regional, yeah, okay. You know, it's really complicated because the U.S. is just, like, so on the warpath that, you know, honestly, China and Russia, too, is in a similar situation, have tried to do the diplomatic thing, it seems like, anyway, and just the U.S. Doesn't really abide by the standards to which it holds other nations, you know? It sort of, like, runs its own show when it comes to these sort of things. So I think China's really in a tricky spot. What they're trying to do is not to provoke the U.S., and they're trying to you know, keep things manageable, but eventually the U.S. is going to just start acting extremely irrationally as it continues to lose its hegemony in the world. But I think what China's only real option is actually what it's doing right now, which is advancing the de-dollarization of its economy and of the BRICS economies as well. So you have China, for example, recently announced that it would offer a triad of oil, yuan, and gold, basically future oil contracts that are converted, the price in the yuan, the Chinese currency, that is convertible into gold. And this is a huge blow to the petrodollar. China also holds all of these U.S. foreign reserves. They hold large amounts of U.S. debt, and they've been buying up gold to back up its own currency for years. You know, so I think China is taking a much more subtle route, in that they're going they're using, you know, economic warfare to retaliate when they can, but not overtly. You know, it's all very behind the scenes. And I think you also have sort of like a, they're planning also for this trade war with the U.S. because the Trump administration, like, has pretty much said a bunch of times that they're trying to declare trade war on China without actually saying it. So I think China's focus is definitely more on economic than political right now. But China is trying to, you know, they just opened their first military base in Africa, I think, not that long ago. So they're trying to expand, you know, their military as they can, but obviously it's not the same thing that the U.S. is currently doing, which has like over 800 military bases in the world. China just opened its first. But they're trying to, you know, do what they can, but it's not, it's, you know, when the U.S. has dominated things for so long and is like has their hands in every pie, it's kind of hard to really protect yourself fully from that. I mean, honestly, the best bet is what they're doing now, like I said, which is economic stuff against the dollar, which protects them if they were to be kicked out of, you know, the SWIFT banking system, for example, which has been threatened to them, and a few other things.
Okay. Well, Whitney Webb, I want to thank you very much for your time and for this providing this analysis for our listeners.
Yeah, no problem. It was fun. So okay. Thanks.
Great. We've been speaking with Whitney Webb. She is a contributor to Mint Press News and is also published on a number of other sites, including Zero Hedge, The Anti-Media, 21st Century Wire, and True Activist. And she spoke to us from Temuco, Chile. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.